You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Cynthia McKinney. Cynthia McKinney has served in the Georgia State Legislature and the United States Congress, where she voted against NAFTA, opposed the war on Iraq, introduced the first resolution for the impeachment of George W. Bush. She did not leave Congress until Diebold voting machines flipped votes away from her right in front of voters' eyes. She has been a Green Party candidate for U.S. President. She recently completed a PhD, I hope I have that right, and we can now call her Dr. Cynthia McKinney. Dr. McKinney, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, and it's been a while, and whenever we reconnect, it's always good.
It is indeed. Remind me what your PhD is in.
I am a proud graduate of the Antioch University PhD in Leadership and Change.
Wonderful. Didn't know.
Yes, and in fact, I hope in a few weeks, actually, to launch a new website. And at the same time, I want to encourage people to download my dissertation. The dissertation was really on the leadership and the legacy on race of Hugo Chavez. And so while it's, oh my gosh, it's 300 pages and of information on that particular topic, but what I sought to do to be true to myself was to also include and to look at his leadership in the context of what it was that he was challenging, and that was the Washington Consensus, the neoliberal order. And so, of course, you can't eliminate then the conversations about Operation Condor and the various assassinations that John Perkins exposed to us, the confessions of the economic hitman, and just the U.S. covert operations in the region and against particular personalities that were able to rise to leadership positions and use that leadership to advance the interests of their people, of which there have been many. So this in one place also is a compilation of COINTELPRO, these official documents. I went through WikiLeaks, and that's a whole story in and of itself, that I had to remove the WikiLeaks documents from my dissertation because, quite frankly, well, you know, you can teach leadership, but then actually doing it and suffering the consequences, which might have been immense for Antioch University and the librarian in particular, because of the impositions now that U.S. law makes on librarians, if you can believe this, for exposing the truth. That's the Patriot Act. And so that became a topic in and of itself that I had to contend with, which extended my time for probably an additional 6 months. And as a result of that, I graduated August 1, 2015 with my PhD. But it was definitely a ride like on a roller coaster.
Well, if you can get me a link to that dissertation, first of all, I'd love to read it, but I'll also put a link to it with this show at talknationradio.org. But, you know, I had heard from complaints from WikiLeaks that U.S. academic organizations and institutions were making it the standard that you could not cite WikiLeaks, State Department cables, and other leaked documents, even though everyone admits they're authentic. But I had not heard of someone actually writing a dissertation and then having to go back and remove WikiLeaks citations.
It speaks to the level of censorship, it becomes self-censorship, and then it becomes censorship. So we don't get an accurate view of U.S. foreign policy behavior or U.S. behavior, period, if we can't use the WikiLeaks documents. And because of my interest in COINTELPRO, I had written in the course of the build-up to the dissertation itself, I wrote about American Indian Movement and the Black Panther Party and COINTELPRO and, of course, Filiberto Ojeda Rios and his really murder and in his home by an FBI SWAT team. So I use those documents, and from what I what I was able to glean from the research from COINTELPRO and looking at the literature, academic literature in preparation for the dissertation, is that academics have not used the COINTELPRO documents, which is not a problem. They have not used the Frank Church committee reports, which is not a problem to use. And but so that means that where we have bona fide U.S. government activity that is outside of the Constitution, outside of legal practice, the academic community is silent. And now with WikiLeaks, it has been silenced.
When you looked at the U.S. relationship with Venezuela, I'm wondering if you saw any change when President George W. Bush left and President Barack Obama moved in and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton took office in terms of U.S. Conduct toward Venezuela and Honduras and other nations of that region.
Well, I think if anything, what happened was the Venezuelan leadership was perhaps more receptive because of the deceptive nature of President Obama. And by that, what I mean is that there was this aura that had been created during the campaign, mind you, that President Obama was going to be different. And during the campaign, candidate Obama, if you recall, was Abraham Lincoln. He was Franklin Roosevelt. He was John Kennedy. He was Martin Luther King Jr. He was all of these
Luke Skywalker
personalities that, you know, some of that we revere as personalities that represented some grand moment in the history of the United States. And so people literally were crying. I remember when he went and spoke at the what used to be the Berlin Wall, remember?
Yeah.
And the Germans were literally crying because they thought that the United States was finally about to turn the page. Well, I can tell you from the WikiLeaks documents that I surveyed and I read there's about 20 little more than 2,200 WikiLeaks documents that refer by name to Venezuela or, you know, the Bolivarian Republic or Hugo Chavez. And there's no change. Absolutely no change. And in fact, in many respects, I think the openness that people received President Obama was abused and allowed for how can I say, the nefarious policies that had been openly objected to insinuate themselves into relationships that had, you know, were based on the idea that this was going to be different.
But I know numerous people, Cynthia, who not only should have known better but did know better, who were in touch with the Venezuelan government. How could they not inform them? How could not just so many Americans but so many people in South America and in Europe fall for this? How can we arrange it so that foreign leaders and foreign activists and people of influence next time ask those in Washington and in the United States who know better and get an accurate report before they go falling for myths and handing out Nobel Peace Prizes?
You're absolutely right about that. And, you know, this is a strange thing because I just happened to be in Paris at the time of, well, two things. I was in Paris at the time of the re-election, the election campaign of Sarkozy.
Yeah.
And Sarkozy was everywhere. He literally was everywhere. But remember, he was like the Minister of Interior, you know, that sort of like the Homeland Security type of person. And so what I saw was the utilization of the apparatus of the state to promote the candidacy of an individual. I don't for one time believe that Nicolas Sarkozy won that election, just because the numbers don't add up. But the phenomenon of, like, seeing his posters everywhere. I mean, literally, if your eyeballs could touch it and it was a public space, Nicolas Sarkozy's posters were there. Well, the strange thing was that a similar kind of phenomenon was taking place in the Obama campaign. And I don't know if you remember it or not, but I was out there, you know, trying to beat the hustings for the Green Party. And it was literally everywhere I went, everywhere I went. And that's not just across the United States. That's literally in the world. So you go to Africa and you see posters of Obama. You go to Haiti, you see posters of Obama.
Yeah.
The Haitians had even painted President Obama, candidate at that time, Obama's picture on their buses. And, you know, they have the little the little private minibus service that they have. And they had Obama's picture posted, I mean, painted on these. It's amazing the level, the spread, so I should say the breadth, and then the depth. So you go to a club trying to get young hip-hoppers to understand that there was an alternative candidate in the race, and then all of a sudden they break out in a chant that was almost like putting somebody in a trance. I'm telling you, I have never experienced anything like that. So they would say it was something like Obama. I can't remember now, but I just remember walking out of I was in the Bay Area, and I remember walking out of this club and shaking my head and saying, this is an intelligence operation, because I'd never seen anything with the breadth and the depth of what I saw for candidate Obama.
Yeah, his first campaign won public relations marketing awards. I mean, top place for marketing a product, and shamelessly, as if that's not a disgraceful sort of thing to be awarded. Let me ask you this, Cynthia McKinney. When we were trying to impeach George W. Bush, everybody told us, oh, you're just hateful and vengeful, and you hate Republicans and so forth. And I said, and many people said, no, 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 we're concerned that the next person's going to be worse. We want better performance out of the next person. Well, there was no impeachment. Congressman Conyers told us it's more important to elect Obama president. And here's Obama. How's his performance been in terms of war and peace and presidential power grabs?
First of all, it's almost, as I was walking out of the Congress for the last time, which was in 2007, January 2007, I remember John Judge saying to me that Congress had ceded all of its powers to the executive branch and had made itself irrelevant. And, I just continue to think about that as the president deals with, as President Obama deals with the executive order. You know, he's the executive order president, right? And, you know, during the time of the campaign, I said he's the teleprompter candidate, and people thought I was hating. They said, oh, you're hating on Obama. And I said, no, I'm not hating on him. I'm just stating the fact. And as it turns out, you know, he's not the, let me just put it this way. It turned out that I was stating a fact and that those elaborate speeches had been written and that he was reading them. And so now it seems that the primary qualification is that you can write a you can read a speech that someone else has written for you. It is a huge increase in the quality of the presidency because George W. Bush couldn't even read them. You know?
That's right.
So, in terms of impeachment, I think George W. Bush earned my impeachment legislation. He earned Dennis Kucinich's impeachment legislation, and Barack Obama has earned impeachment legislation, but no one dare do it now.
Yeah, it seems to me that George W. Bush at least had the decency to go to Congress and lie to them and badger them and get them to sort of kind of authorize his wars. When it comes to these drone wars or the war on Libya, for example, has Congress even been asked?
Well, the only thing I can say is that, you know, I just posted this morning that I really wish that the Russians and the Chinese had done a double veto for Libya the way they did for Syria. And we see that, you know, the objective of destroying Syria has already been met. And I'm flipping through.
But they want to overthrow the government,
trying to do
too,
my research,
right?
For my dissertation. And I'm flipping through these journals, and I find this field called cliodynamics. And basically, it's if you mash up a country, if you mess that country up, and you totally destroy it, how long is it going to take for that country to, get back on its feet and have functioning institutions? And basically, you're looking at, say a decade or two. So suppose you are a superpower and the world is about to burst into multipolarity. And suppose you are a country that feels that it is under siege, and you have been able to insinuate your interest into this failing, into the state apparatus of this failing, about to fail, unipolar moment. So you've got this confluence of interests that come together and serve each other's purposes. And so the destruction of these countries is a lead up to the destruction of the main countries that can threaten the unipolar moment. at the same time, you've got the destruction of these countries that also serves to extend the suzerainty, and I'm talking about the Yunnan plan, I'm talking about the A Clean Break plan that was written by the Project for a New American Century boys. And so basically you've got the confluence of the Cold Warriors and the Israel First People. And as a result of that, they continue to win, win, and win. So we see the destruction, total destruction of Libya, the total destruction of Syria, right there at the doorstep of Iran. President keeps talking about the failures of Iran, and we know that Iran is only a threshold away from Russia itself. So we've got NATO expansion, we've got the frontal attack economically on Russia, on Brazil, the containment of China. We've got all of this stuff going on at the same time. I don't know how many people are actually able to understand what is happening and how the U.S. military is being used right now to attain certain objectives that don't benefit me. They don't benefit you, David. They don't benefit my mom and my mom's next-door neighbor. They don't benefit the average, ordinary American. But we've got whistleblowers who have told us that there are some people who actually get very, very wealthy. The more instability in the world there is, the more chaos that is sown, the more wars and destruction that is created, the more profits some people make. And the apparatus of the state now has been captured by these people. And we have this whistleblower like Scott Bennett, who said that he was tasked with studying terror, quote-unquote, terror finance. And what it came back to was thousands of Swiss bank accounts that were controlled by the CIA. And these folk, well, really, they didn't want peace to break out because there was so much profit and money in war.
Let me ask you this, Cynthia, with about 5 minutes to go. A lot of people who do come around to recognizing the really openly stated goal of the U.S. government of overthrowing these foreign governments think that the U.S. government's ideal goal is really sort of a surgical regime change. They'd like to just change the government of Iraq and Libya and Syria, and they accidentally mishandle it, and in the process they kill a million people and they create chaos and turmoil and ISIS and so forth, and those are sort of accidents. While they've destroyed much of Syria and helped destroy much of Syria, they're really interested in just overthrowing the government of Syria. The way you describe it, it sounds like turning these nations and the regions they're in into chaos and disaster is really the goal.
Absolutely. And so that's why I say that these interests have won. And people are saying, well, you know, Syria, they haven't won in Syria. Well, what's victory? Victory is the creation of chaos such that Syria is no longer a threat to anyone, and that, and as Wesley Clark said on Fox News, he said that ISIS was created to destroy Hezbollah. So now you've got Hezbollah contributing to the defense of the territorial integrity of Syria, and then, you know, so now Hezbollah is involved. So I think, quite frankly, that these folks have won, and that we are being misinformed and sadly disinformed by even some people on the so-called progressive left. Quite frankly, I think the disinformation occurs because at the end of the day, you know, it's really hard to be an independent actor now. It's hard to raise money when the entire assets of the people of the United States are being stripped and new oligarchs are being created in the U.S. economy in exactly the same way as was done in what, you know, at that period between Gorbachev and Yeltsin, the Soviet Union, and Russia.
With a few minutes left, Cynthia, what can people do in 2016 to make things better, to move toward peace and justice? It was a little bit encouraging a couple of years ago to have people rise up and say no to missile strikes on Syria, but they kept arming the so-called moderates and sending in the weaponry, and then we saw videos of beheadings and everybody got scared and people accepted war. What can we do to turn this trend back the other way?
I think really people like you and me, it's difficult. It's really, really difficult to go on. But I think we really have to go on with our truth telling, with our translation, what I now call myself a translator. So I translate the disinformation speak and sort of expose it as what's really being done and what's really being said. And if we continue to do that and utilize social media as long as we can, as long as we have social media, it's something that we really can do for free. We just need to intensify our efforts so that we can reach more people.
I think that is an excellent goal, translating Washington speak into normal honest English. I think we could use a great deal more of that. We have like 1 minute left. Where can people follow what you're doing and support what you're doing in the months ahead?
Oh, well, you know, I will definitely send you my website address after I get it up and running. And in the meantime, they can find me at Cynthia McKinney Official on Facebook, and then I'm at Cynthia McKinney on Twitter. And my email address, as always, which you will post on your website.
Sure. I will do that if you want me to, absolutely. Cynthia McKinney has been in the Georgia State Legislature and the United States Congress, and we miss her there. There is not the same voice for peace that there was when people like Cynthia and Dennis Kucinich were in the Congress. The things she voted on against pressure turned out to be right, including NAFTA and the war on Iraq, and she introduced the first resolution for impeachment of George W. Bush. Cynthia McKinney has been a Green Party candidate for U.S. president. We're having a little bit of trouble with the Republican and Democrats, if anyone hasn't noticed. Dr. Cynthia McKinney with a doctorate in leadership and action, is that it?
Leadership and change.
Leadership and change. Cynthia McKinney, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, time to say.
Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the arrest of storied Mexican drug cartel leader Joaquin El Chapo Guzman raises questions. How can a person sought vigorously by law enforcement from at least two countries be unearthed by Sean Penn? And if the reason the arrest is so significant is its impact within the war on drugs, what really is that impact? Laura Carlson is the director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy in Mexico City. She'll join us to talk about that. Also on the show, it's Barack Obama's legacy time, say elite media. And one of the questions is whether he can fulfill what's described as a personal quest to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. What if reporters approached the military prison as a problem for detainees and for the rule of law, rather than an item on Obama's to-do list? We'll hear from Omar Shaker, fellow at the Bertha Justice Institute at the Center for Constitutional Rights. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. Media are heralding South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley's Republican rebuttal to Obama's State of the Union address. Haley's call for the party to resist the siren call of the angriest voices was, according to AP, a message of, quote, diversity and openness to immigrants that could answer the GOP establishment's increasingly desperate search for an antidote to the loud pronouncements of presidential frontrunner Donald Trump, close quote. The L.A. Times cited Haley's words that, quote, no one who is willing to work hard, abide by our laws, and love our traditions should ever feel unwelcome in this country, close quote. Noting that for those just noticing Haley, quote, she probably seemed like a voice of reason in a campaign that has often featured the opposite, close quote. And when Trump predictably attacked Haley as weak on illegal immigration, many outlets noted her remark, I stand by what I believe. You might have wanted a little more detail, though, on what it is Haley seems to actually believe, because as Gawker pointed out, it's pretty weird. When you've got immigrants who are coming here legally, Haley reportedly said to reporters in South Carolina, quote, we've never in the history of this country passed any laws or done anything based on race or religion. Let's not start that now, close quote. The LA Times thought Haley's showing in her rebuttal speech would have implications for her future. Maybe in the meantime, someone could help her brush up on the past. What is it with Fox News and Powerball? On the January 9th episode of Fox and Friends Saturday, someone dubbed a lottery expert came on to dispense such sound financial advice as never miss a draw and buy as many tickets as you can afford. As Media Matters noted, January 12th featured a Fox Business panel in which the one guest who noted that your chances of winning the lottery are nothing was upbraided by guest host Charles Payne, saying things like, quote, a buck. You can't put a buck on this thing, close quote. The next day, Fox's website promoted the column Powerball, Why You Should Buy a Ticket, by frequent Fox commentator Dr. Keith Ablow, who reminds us he's a psychiatrist who understands statistics before enthusing that the lottery is an incredible deal financially. Just think about it, says Ablow. Quote, winning Powerball could be the best return on $2 ever in the history of the world. It's a little bit of a miracle that that is possible, no? Tens of millions of people had to contribute to the Powerball frenzy to make it so. How can you not part with $2 to be a part of it? Close quote. Another question might be why you would take financial advice from Fox News. And finally, word this week that Al Jazeera America will shut down. The channel had its problems, including the fact that its primary patron was the Qatari government, whose budget deficit is behind the closing. But as frequent contributor Ari Paul wrote for Fair.org, in a TV news market saturated with screaming pundits, a channel dedicated to covering U.S. issues and the world seriously seemed like a worthy gamble. Paul noted also the network's focus on covering economic inequality, and that, strangely enough, for being fueled by a petrol monarchy, it hired journalists with class consciousness and a critical eye when it came to U.S. foreign policy. Those are elements in short supply in elite media. As the shop had just been organized last year by the News Guild of New York, the closing also represents a setback for media unions. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. U.S. media fined drug cartel leader Joaquin El Chapo Guzman Loera a colorful character. And the fact that media played a role in his recent capture, Guzman appears to have been caught out by his own Hollywood ambitions. His arrest followed a meeting with actors Sean Penn and Kate Del Castillo about a proposed biopic. Well, that just made the story still more likely to garner press attention in the U.S. But is the story serving as an opening for serious questions about the efficacy and impact of the U.S. war on drugs in Mexico? Joining us now to discuss these issues is Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. She joins us by phone from Mexico City. Welcome back to Counterspin, Laura Carlson.
Thank you, Janine. Thanks for the invitation to be on the show.
Well, it's not to say that the arrest is not significant, but you might imagine from some of the U.S. coverage that Guzman was single-handedly killing Chicago youth and hand-delivering billions of dollars of drugs. I'm not holding my breath for mention of money laundering by HSBC Bank, for example, for which the bank received a deferred prosecution agreement brokered by Loretta Lynch, who now, as Attorney General, we're told is very amped to get at El Chapo. But still, there are clearly other institutional players that are key to a drug cartel's operations. So how much or how little is that bigger picture going to be affected by Guzman's capture?
I think it's going to be affected very little, if at all. What we know about this strategy, the kingpin strategy that the Drug Enforcement Administration of the United States has been imposing on Mexico through the drug war and in other places in the world, it doesn't work. What happens is that they take out a capo, even a capo with the kind of power that Joaquin Guzman had, and the jobs are distributed within the cartel. There's always other people who can do them. We know that from the fact that Joaquin Guzman was already in prison, and the cartel really continued to traffic illicit drugs and to carry out the rest of its operations much the same, even the DEA says, without really any appreciable change during that time. So what we're expecting is that there won't be a significant impact on drug trafficking to the United States and not on the amount of violence that it generates here in Mexico either.
Well, the New York Times on January 12th had a piece, El Chapo Case Draws Mexico Closer to U.S., which celebrated that now Mexico has started letting U.S. agents carry guns. You know, I was struck by the fact that at one point the story said that early in his administration, quote, instead of focusing on security, catching kingpins, and intercepting drugs, Mr. Peña Nieto wanted to make trade and economics the priority, close quote. Now, I know what the Times is trying to say here, that Peña Nieto tried to deflect from concerns about safety with some kind of neoliberal hand-waving, and I'm not even saying that's wrong, but I just find it interesting the way that language accepts a division or even a contrast between drug trafficking and economics. You know, drugs are a security issue and not an economic story. That seems to be a big mistake.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that we see it in the fact that these operations do continue after all these sophisticated security measures and the billions of dollars that go into the intelligence and sending the armed forces into the streets in Mexico. There's no impact on this. And that really has to do with the fact that this problem is at root an economic problem. We're talking about a market of approximately, and of course the guesses are over a wide range because they are guesses, given that due to prohibition, it's a clandestine market. But we're talking about approximately $38 billion a year. With that kind of money at stake, you can bet that no matter what happens, these cartels, which are transnational, they're not just in Mexico, they take the drugs over the border with the complicity of agents there, and they're distributed to cities throughout the United States, and you really don't hear much of that part either. But you can bet that these operations will go on because of how lucrative the business is.
Well, to its credit, the Los Angeles Times did end their piece with a quote from a former DEA agent making just the point that you're making, that the arrest of Joaquin Guzman is unlikely to slow Sinaloa drug trafficking. But the problem is that the story ends there, you know, rather than sort of beginning there. If we're serious about talking about ending the violence in particular associated with the drug war, where might coverage go from there?
Well, it's been striking that nobody is really discussing that. And I think that has to do with the way this drug war has been taken to the terrain of image rather than real impact on the lives of people or improving the situation, which is dire here in Mexico, of the citizenry being held prey to organized crime in complicity with government officials. No one is talking about how now with the arrest of El Chapo Guzman, there should be investigations that enable them to dismantle the financial empire of the Sinaloa cartel, which is huge. They're not talking about what's going to happen on the money laundering front. And what we've seen in the past is that very little happens, although supposedly they would now have the gold mine of information in terms of how the Sinaloa cartel operates and how it moves money around through legitimate banks, as you mentioned before, and how it continues this as a business. With all this information, in the past when they've captured El Chapo Guzman, they have not made a dent on that financial empire. And there's where you get the distinct impression that there are very powerful economic interests, both in Mexico and in the United States, that are being protected, even as headlines are splashed all over the world regarding the capture of kingpins. So this strategy in many ways is a smokescreen. And smokescreen, if you look at the social networks and the response of the Mexican people, is a word that comes up quite frequently. What they're saying is, yes, they captured El Chapo Guzman for the third time because they let him go twice. Yet nobody's talking about who's behind it. They're not talking about the government officials that were undoubtedly involved in his escapes in the past and what's going to happen to them. They're not talking about how to bring down the Sinaloa cartel. And nobody is providing any guarantee or even simple statements in terms of how this could diminish illicit drug trafficking or weaken the Sinaloa cartel and the other cartels here in Mexico that operate in the United States with the complicity of networks in the United States as well.
Well, I want to draw you out just finally on that complicity because it's interesting. It's not that you don't hear references to corruption with regard to the Mexican government, but when we talk about drug cartels, the impression that you get from U.S. media, which it is a lot about image, it's the image that the Mexican state is weak and the portrayal is of the United States needing to go in and sort of shore up the Mexican state or the Peña Nieto government so that they can fight the drug cartels, so that they can fight the violence. But if the problem is complicity and corruption, then strengthening the state, you know, as simple as that, doesn't seem to be the right way forward.
No, it's really a pretense for intervention in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And we've seen the way that the embassy has grown, the way that security forces, United States security forces, and intelligence forces have come into Mexico with this pretext and have really developed a presence that before they couldn't develop because of concerns and very legitimate concerns about national sovereignty. So you also see that when they talk about corruption, this idea that the cartels are infiltrating cities within the United States, that they're running the drug trafficking operations in the United States, that El Chapo is responsible for the heroin that's killing people in Chicago almost single-handedly, all this is a way to ignore the problem that exists in the United States and the failures that exist in the United States. Every border has two sides. Every once in a while, we have a case of some local sheriff in Texas or low-level official who's caught as being part of this network, and yet there's almost no discussion of how these drugs are able to pass into the United States and be distributed throughout the country with almost no hindrance. So the idea that Mexico is the only country that's involved in corruption here, the idea that the Mexican state is the only government that is failing in terms of this war on drugs, is really, again, another smokescreen and another way of not looking at the responsibility of the United States. People talk about the responsibility of the United States in terms of consumption, and yet when you look at the root problems, it's corruption in the United States, and it's also the whole regime of prohibition. By prohibiting these drugs, and especially marijuana, now when you have such a strong grassroots feeling that it's not even a particularly dangerous drug and it's already legalized in a number of states, this is really the problem that we have to take a look at. Wouldn't it be better to get rid of prohibition so that these markets can be regulated and so that the United States can take on its role of actually tracking these drugs and avoiding this situation in which criminals, by definition, are the ones who benefit from the trafficking?
We've been speaking with Laura Carlson of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. You can find their work online at ciponline.org. Laura Carlson, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
It was widely noted that Barack Obama's last State of the Union address contained the same promise as his first, that he would move to close the military detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, now entering its 14th year. Media present closing Guantanamo as Obama's quest, something he wants badly. That he has struggled mightily to close the prison is one presumption. The more striking one is that Guantanamo is above all Obama's problem, rather than that of the hundreds of people who've been held there, or a society aspiring to democracy that permits a prison that operates outside the law. We're joined now by Omar Shaker. He's the Bertha Fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He joins us by phone from New York. Welcome to Counterspin, Omar Shaker.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I understand Beltway reporters' tendency to report on Guantanamo Bay as about Barack Obama, you know, his legacy, his power. That's not irrelevant, but there's just so much else at stake. Some of our listeners were in grade school when Guantanamo Bay opened. Remind us why it opened. What was the supposed purpose in 2002?
Sure. The Bush administration opened Guantanamo to create a prison that was beyond the reach of any law. They explicitly chose it so that U.S. constitutional and other law would not apply. In their minds, the nature of U.S. control over that base meant that international law wouldn't apply, Cuban law wouldn't apply. It was meant to be an area where they could use torture and other brutal interrogation tactics as they wanted, where they could hold people without charge, where they could conduct trials without basic due process protections. It was meant mostly for that purpose, and in addition to be far removed, so that could easily sort of be hidden from the conscious of most Americans and out of sight, out of mind, and a place where they could bring whoever they wanted, whenever they wanted, for as long as they wanted.
Well, that sounds dystopian, and I guess it's amazing the degree to which it was kind of accepted or has become normalized, at least by U.S. media. CBS affiliate story recently on five Yemeni men who were released to the United Arab Emirates just sort of reported none of the men had been charged with a crime, but they'd been detained as enemy combatants, you know, as though this were, you know, a kind of generally understood legal terminology, and as though it made sense. So who was there, who is there still in Guantanamo Bay? Who got caught up in it?
So we currently, as of today, have 93 individuals left in Guantanamo. Over the history of Guantanamo, 780 individuals have been held there. All are Muslim men and boys. Out of the 780, the vast majority have not been charged with any crime at all. You know, most were cleared for release. You have a lot of people, as the former U.S. envoy for Guantanamo's closure put it, that simply were not the worst of the worst, but a direct quote, had the worst of luck. A lot of people that were brought over because the U.S. was offering bounties in late 2001, early 2002, to local villagers who turned in anyone they suspected of militants, which obviously poor communities meant people turning in anybody that they could make any kind of case. You know, maybe they were, you know, not from that town, or they had a personal gripe with them. The U.S.'s own numbers say that only 8% were ever al-Qaeda fighters. There's even a smaller percentage of numbers that the U.S. actually claims were involved in any sort of combat. At the end of the day, you have more people that have died in Guantanamo than actually have been convicted by a court. So that should give you some perspective of, now that we commemorate the 14th anniversary of Guantanamo's opening, 15 years for many men there. You know, we still have a reality where men continue to languish without charge, and many of whom have been cleared for release.
Fair took the New York Times to task in 2009 for a story on a leaked Pentagon report, which they headlined, "One in Seven Freed Detainees Rejoins Fight," report finds. I mean, it was talking about former prisoners from Guantanamo returning to terrorism or militant activity when, as you've just explained, in many or most cases, they've not been shown to have been involved in any in the first place. And yet for reporters, this image of Guantanamo as holding the worst of the worst, and we've seen politicians pick up on this, it had something to do with the fact that and there were exceptions, folks like Carol Rosenberg, who really did hard independent work. But in general, there was a reliance on the Pentagon as the source for any knowledge you were getting out of Guantanamo. And that turned out not to be, you know, the best route to reliable information.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think a lot of this has to do with Islamophobia and the reality that fear-mongering has always been the primary justification for the ongoing detention of folks at Guantanamo Bay. And I think those leaks also, if you sort of look at the timing, it's always bureaucrats, usually in the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, FBI, that have their own reasons for wanting Guantanamo open, who are selectively leaking, in many cases, inaccurate information, or even if it has some accuracy in it, it's being framed in a way to sort of further the opportunistic politicians that want to bank on fear-mongering as a way to either criticize President Obama or to sort of scuttle efforts to close Guantanamo. So the way that that sort of reverberates in media and in political circles, I think, is deeply problematic, and those folks deserve a lot of the blame for Guantanamo still being open in 2016.
Well, it's not that the obstacles aren't real, but what can we say about Obama's capacity to move the issue? Could he not do more?
Absolutely can. I mean, it is very real that there are obstacles both within his own administration and in Congress. But at the same time, these obstacles emerged as a result of the fact that from the beginning, while President Obama did on his second day in office issue executive orders calling for the closure of Guantanamo, from the early days of that administration, it was not followed up with a concrete plan of action and a set of steps to actually effectuate it. The own way he went about the first year and on into subsequent years, you know, provided space for these obstacles to emerge. And as soon as they emerged, they were the excuse for no action. On his own, based on his own authority, can release guys that are cleared for release. I mean, we're talking about out of the 93 detainees left, 34 of them are cleared for release. Tomorrow, President Obama could put them on an airplane, send them away. Of the remaining detainees, you have 49 of whom who are waiting hearings by the Periodic Review Board that have been clearing the vast majority of detainees. If those review boards were expedited, as President Obama promised to do all hearings within a year, if he actually followed through with expediting that, you would have many more men cleared for release. If the military commission system, which has been fraught with abuses and serious due process violations, were once and for all done away with, and those that the U.S. does suspect of criminal involvement were charged in federal courts, and the administration used a simple charge or release paradigm very familiar to prosecutors, we could, on his own power, close Guantanamo in a matter of days, not months or years.
Well, it was interesting in the State of the Union speech that Obama said, in which, you know, many media credited him for revealing yet again his urge, his strong compulsion to close Guantanamo. What he actually said is, I will keep working to shut down the prison at Guantanamo. It's expensive. It's unnecessary, and it only serves as a recruitment brochure for our enemies. Anytime a criticism of an abusive practice or policy begins with, it's expensive, you know, it's not really inspiring. You know, it doesn't really give you the feeling that the problem is the absence of due process, that the problem is putting people in a black hole of a prison that's opaque to the public and that's outside of the rule of law. You know, his opposition, it doesn't seem to be based on what some of us would call the right reasons.
Right. The core injustice is indefinite detention, is this idea that you can have individuals who are now in their 15th year of detention under U.S. control, who the U.S. government has said pose no threat, are cleared for release, who have never been charged with a crime, but yet wake up each day in Guantanamo and have no idea whether that will be the day that they're released, whether they could die there, whether they'll ever see their families again. That core injustice, and that's not going to be, you know, solved by the reports that the president is thinking about transferring Guantanamo to a federal prison in the United States. That's not closing Guantanamo. That's merely changing its zip code and not addressing the core injustice.
We've been speaking with Omar Shaker of the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can find their work on Guantanamo, along with their work on other issues, online at ccrjustice.org. Omar Shaker, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
In these wild and confusing times, I look hard for wise heads to help guide us. We want someone not so dedicated to the power system that they just lull us with sweet propaganda. And we want sources not so far out that they baffle us with twisted facts. And I think our next guest may fill that sweet spot in between. Now, outside the official United Nations climate press conferences at Lima and Paris, we got other voices, powerful voices, through a group I knew little about. It's called the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. Is it reliable? Wait until you hear who's involved. Here are just a few of the many founding members: James Hansen, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Carrie Emanuel, Catherine Hayhoe, Rabbi David Rosen, Swami Saraswati, Michael Mann, Reverend Sally Bingham, Michael Oppenheimer, the list goes on and on. So often chairing these high-powered press conferences in different cities, all recorded as YouTube videos, is Stuart Scott. He's the founder and director of strategic planning for the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. Stuart Scott, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm really quite honored.
Well, later, I'd like to find out how you drew together so many top scientists and spiritual leaders into a strong climate alliance. But would you mind, Stuart, if we start first with some of the most pressing problems for our listeners?
I start wherever you like. I have real confidence in the shows that you put together. So,
okay. Well, now, a month ago, I gave a heads up to our listeners that the economic system is teetering on the edge even more than usual. And that's a hard one. We don't want to suffer. We don't want our loved ones and neighbors to suffer. Yet if we keep going with this fossil-powered heat engine we call civilization, we will wreck the climate if we haven't done it already. Do you think an economic crash could be a real way to slash emissions quickly?
Well, that's a really good place to start. Let me segue into answering it kind of laterally. For me, the climate problem is one of an array of ecological problems and environmental problems that we have. We have more than just those. We have a huge problem of inequity, where you're well known, 1% richest people make more than 80% of the poorest people. But the specifics of the ecological crisis that we're going through, of which climate is the leading edge, is a direct result of what I call a defective operating system for global civilization. And that operating system is known conventionally by two names, money and economics. Now, the economics part, the brand of economics we have is a particular brand. It's growth economics. It's actually called neoclassical growth economics. And after 100 years of only having that, people have kind of become used to it as the only game in town, or the only possibility even. It's the only thing we can conceive of. Well, it's not. And unless we change our economic folly very quickly, and it will change on its own if we don't do so of our own volition, unless we can manage to change this rapacious economic system in a way that it will function in harmony with the planet rather than devouring the planet, we are looking at a collapse of civilization, as far as I can tell. Climate, as I say, is just the leading edge. We have plenty of other scales of ecological health or unhealth of the planet that are similarly being violated. You know, the nitrogen cycle, the water cycle, phosphorus, various key elements which are on all of these dimensions, we are reaching problem territory. But climate, as I say, is the leading edge. It's the one that's going to impact us quickly. So to get back to your question, not only would an economic, let's say, mildly an economic downturn, notice how the growth economists always want to frame any kind of degrowth, any kind of contraction of the economy as bad, and we'll be getting back to growth again soon, folks, so just stay tuned and keep buying, go out there and buy. So unless we have a sustained leveling off, if not downturn, then we will have an economic crash. And I view that economic crash as pulling us back from an ecological crash, which is even far more dangerous. The economic crash, as you kind of said, it'll be bad for people's well-being and health and livelihood, and the banks will foreclose. And we know what it'll look like, the way the system is set up. Economic downturns, the banks are the only people, the only agencies that make out. But if we have the kind of climate future that many scientists are saying we're headed directly and quickly towards, then it's going to be a loss of easily half the population of Earth. And I say half the population when I say that to many people I interact with. They say, oh, if we get off easy, it'll be only half.
Wow.
So we're talking about very, very serious dimensions here.
Well, my other concern about an economic crash is it may freeze us into our current energy system. You know, the electric grid that wastes half of all the power produced, the old coal and nuclear plants will stick with them. What if there is no money to transition to a clean energy system?
There are arguments that could be made in both directions there, and it's one of those we're not quite sure until we cross that bridge, until we see what, if we get the big downturn, the collapse, the slowdown, what the response is. But there are individuals and organizations, corporations, who are hell-bent on impeding the transition to renewables, to less impactful sources of energy, no matter what. No matter what. So I'm not sure that the downturn, when the lack of capital, will be the main problem.
Let's talk a little bit about China. Economic pundits used to say demand from rising China would rejuvenate growth in the world, and you've outlined the point that we really just can't take a lot more growth in the way we look at it. Well, now it comes, there's a bit of a slump in China, a rocky stock market there. Stuart Scott, where do you think China fits into our struggle to avoid dangerous climate change?
Well, it's a very good question. China is the game changer globally. Their economy quickly, over the past couple of decades, grew to rival that of the United States. And I'm not sure if it's now a bigger economy than the American economy. But, of course, the two are interwoven. So to say who's bigger is it's not very relevant. They are both simultaneously growing big for the same reasons. But China has the political advantage, and I'm sure a lot of people in America and the so-called world of democracy will take exception to this. China has the advantage of not having an easily manipulated bi-party or multi-party system. And I say easily manipulated because as smart as we think we are, it is fairly easy to manipulate a population and get them to vote one way or another. It's like presidential contests in the U.S. have become more a question of who's got more money to spend, whose PR guys are better. You know, we've seen some presidents sold into office who we scratch our heads, wonder how they got there. And in fact, now a lot of people say that about some of the current candidates, and I won't mention names because I try to stay politically neutral. It's difficult, especially when one party in the U.S. aligns itself more or less with denial that climate is a problem. In any case, China having a single party, which is all-powerful, can turn on a dime. I was told that when China wanted to do away with disposable plastic bags, they hired 450,000 inspectors to go bust shop and shopkeepers who were still giving out free plastic bags. So China can turn on a dime when it wants to. Now, I am working with James Hansen this year since he responded positively to my invitation to come to COP21. And that was actually the first COP, the first conference of parties to the Kyoto Protocols that he ever attended. I'm hoping that he and I will have a closer working relationship this year. But his information to me in one of our emails was that China is where the change will happen this year. China is where the action will be. And I believe what he means is that China has the need, the ability, the financial resources to turn to renewable sources of energy very quickly. And he is inside of their thinking to some degree. He just got back from a trip to China that he went to after Paris talks were over. So his assessment was made after his return to the U.S. from that trip. So China, I think we're going to see them turning the quickest and hopefully setting the way. And also, they will be eating our lunch, continuing to eat our lunch in terms of developing of the renewable energy infrastructure. And I mean, they're the leading supplier of solar panels now, and we'll probably follow that up with all kinds of large-scale and small-scale alternative energy implementations.
Well, I don't want to pour a cold lunch on that, but I do know that Dr. James Hansen is also very strongly advocating nuclear energy, and that the Chinese are building, I believe, at least 29 new nuclear plants. Yes, they're leading in wind. Yes, they're leading in solar, but they're also going heavily nuclear, and that worries me, especially after Fukushima.
The nuclear question is one that I have to deal with very deftly, because it is a very hot-button topic for good reasons. Humanity has lots of hubris, and we don't have a very good track record at containing anything, no less something that needs to be contained for a quarter of a million years or so. So yes, I have traditionally had great reservations about nuclear power, but Dr. Hansen got together with three other well-known scientists in Paris and did a press conference, and I actually helped publicize the press conference. I'm not ashamed of that at all. And what they're talking about, what these four scientists went on record as saying, is that we will not be able to make the turn away from what I will call certain death, the continuation of greenhouse gas emissions unabated, unless we allow nuclear to be in the mix. And they are not talking about the old style nuclear. They're talking about what's called fourth generation nuclear, which is not ready for commercial deployment now. I'll be honest, as far as I know, it's not. There are two forms, and the one that I know of is called liquid thorium. It has a small footprint in terms of the amount of space it takes. It actually digests the conventional nuclear waste from the old style of power plant, making it non-fissible, that is non-bomb-making material, a much smaller amount of it, much shorter half-life. So it's, in many respects, it's a solution to problems we've created with the first couple of generations of nuclear power. So I'm not going to hold myself out as a proponent. I'm kind of the messenger, so don't shoot the messenger. But from gentlemen who are very, very studied about the trends and problems from a macro level, they don't see us dodging the bullet unless we allow nuclear to be in the mix. Now, Dr. Hansen did say that there's a quasi-religious opposition to nuclear power that is unhelpful. I would just urge people to consider all the facts and not just go with a knee-jerk reaction.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, because I want to move on to another hot topic, and that's the possibility of abrupt climate change. Your group, the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative, helped our guest and climate scientist Paul Beckwith get that information out at COP meetings. Do you personally think abrupt climate change is a serious risk? And if so, what could happen?
Well, yes, and the short answer is yes, I think it's a very serious risk. Now, I look at our futures in a more nuanced fashion, in that I kind of constantly am factoring the risk of something happening times the severity of what will occur if it does happen. And that helps me determine my priority list of what I want to work on, what needs to be paid attention to. And I think it's a serious enough risk that we should be treating it as though it were imminent. Because if it is real, and there are some very credible scientists, besides Paul Beckwith, who's become a good friend in the last couple of years, there's Dr. Peter Wadhams, Dr. Natalia Shakova, and others, Dr. Jason Box, others who have gone up to the northern latitudes of the planet, the Arctic zones, and observed methane releases. And methane is the showstopper. Methane is the gun going off. If there is a methane burp, as it's been called, if there's a huge sustained methane release, as there appears to be underway, then that could be just the game over signal. So we need to treat that with, I think, all due haste. And I believe that there should be research going on to how do we artificially pull the northern regions of the planet, the Arctic zone of the planet. And that brings up another quasi-religious hot button, which is the G word, not the God word, the geoengineering word, because people, rightly so, question our ability to get it right. We have geoengineered our way into this mess. What do you think? Hundreds of millions of cars and trucks running around on stored sunlight in the form of carbon fuels. What do you think that is? That's geoengineering. We just geoengineered our way into the problem without calling it that, without knowing it was that. So that's the paradigm. We are geoengineering the planet. The question is, can we come up with a wiser way of geoengineering our way out of the mess that we've created?
Lots of debate on that. Moving on again, well-respected scientists like James Hansen and Peter Ward warn that rising seas will be the first and worst big impact of climate change. Do you think it could be something else?
Yes, I don't think that. That's one place where I disagree with Dr. Hansen. He, by the way, to be fair, he is somewhat dismissive about the situation with the Arctic methane. You'd have to class him as one of the modelers. And the expeditionary scientists who go up there and see the methane happening and measure it in the water column, they say, come and look. But the modelers say, well, our models say that it can't be happening yet. So there's a standoff there, and I can't begin to resolve that one. But I think there's a huge cause for concern there. Hopefully, I'll be able to get Dr. Hansen to maybe go up and do some observations himself and see whether that changes his position on the methane release.
And what about the whole issue of the threat to our food production? We've seen a mini edition of that in California with the drought and food prices going up because of it. But, you know, as the world warms, this could get much, much worse.
Yes, I'm sorry. I lost the thread of your previous question. Thanks for essentially leading me back to it. I don't think rising sea levels is the worst that we face. I think that food shortages, collapse of our ability to grow food in certain regions, certain nations, will be the worst that we face. Because when people get hungry, governments fall. It is said by many that the war in Syria, which was capitalized upon by ISIS, they took political control in a power, not vacuum, but a power contest between the government that was not taking care of its people when they were experiencing the trouble with their extended drought and their crop failures. We will be seeing this more and more and more. There's a set of four maps that I show whenever I do my presentations about climate, which show and your audience can find them online by Googling University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, and they had four predictive drought maps. Well, actually, one was for the first decade, and then it was the one-third, two-third, and final decade of this century. And they are mind-blowing as to what's predicted by conservative science in terms of the drying out of huge areas of the planet. And it looks like, at least from the rainfall perspective, that the northern latitudes of China, Russia, and Canada will be where most of the food will have to come from by the end of this century, by the latter third of this century. But the soils there are not well-developed soils because those have been perennially frozen land. So you've got thin soil, which will be getting adequate rain and will probably be inadequate to feed a population of 7 to 9 billion people. I think we're looking at a collapse of human population in this century.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Stuart Scott, founder of the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. Stuart, are you a scientist? What is your background?
Well, my background, I'm well-trained in many sciences. I'm not an expert. I don't hold myself out to be an expert, but I graduated from Columbia University with a wide training in physics and chemistry and biology. But I specialized in mathematics. I taught mathematics and statistics and critical thinking at the college level for several years before I literally quit my day job to do climate work full time. So I look at trends, I evaluate things with a critical eye, and I try to discern what are the most important trends and facts of all that I look at and study, and what's the most reliable, who's saying what, and how many people are of credibility are agreeing and disagreeing. I come up with a synthesis of my own that then I combine with my other skills, which I seem to have a skill at public presentation. I go out and make these presentations about the climate problem, and that over the years has led me to a more and more refined strategy on how do I make change? How do I try to create the change in the direction that I feel we need, because I have no particular fortune or fame to work with. And that's actually how I came up with this United Planet Faith and Science Initiative, realizing that I could make the best contribution by focusing the authority of others on the problem I felt we had.
How did you manage to do that? You've got some tremendous names involved.
Well, it actually came out of a 2009 project, which literally it emerged from my meditation. You know, it was a spiritual inspiration. I all of a sudden, in a moment, saw intact what I had to do, and I called it the Interfaith Declaration on Climate Change. And a friend who I'd met at one of the lesser climate talks in Bonn, Germany, he and I wrote a one-page document called that, the Interfaith Declaration on Climate Change. And because I had this epiphany of sorts where I realized that while you can describe the problem in terms of physics, greenhouse gases, whatnot, that the cause was we were trying to fill an inner lack with stuff, with trips and vacations and iPods and iPads and whatnot. And that actually, if we were happier with ourselves, we might be less into consuming things and there might be less of a problem. Of course, we have a system where those appetites are provoked by advertising constantly. That's the basis of this defective operating system, as I call it. But I realized that there was a valid place for trying to address the climate problem through the auspices of spiritual leaders. And it turned out that I would always have a scientist present when I did one of these events. And then I realized that science was a necessary member of the party, needed a seat at the table, and that actually we were looking at a consensus of not just all religious leaders. And when have you known religious leaders of many different faiths to agree on things? Well, here we have a huge consensus amongst all the faiths on the climate problem, and that consensus is shared by science. Well, this is kind of remarkable. And so I changed the name from Interfaith Declaration and changed it to United Planet, as in United Nations, Erase the Borders, United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. And I called it initiative at the recommendation of one of our founding members, who said, if you're anything else but an initiative, then you will be perceived as competition by other interfaith organizations. So you want to be perceived as something that will come and go away. You're not competing for donations or dollars. So we are an initiative, the Faith and Science Initiative. And we put it out to widely to the spiritual community and to scientists, and we got a very, very good response. So it is a very deeply felt homage to both the camps of science and spirituality. And the overlap, because there is an overlap. There are individuals who see no problem, no contradiction between one and the other.
Well, that can be a problem, though, because I know some of our listeners become suspicious as soon as they hear religion is involved. Others might embrace it. But there has been a long history of religion denying, even suppressing science. We're still seeing it in the U.S. Congress off and on. So why should we trust the voices of religions now on this critical issue?
You know, everybody's got to answer that for themselves when it comes down to it. But a good start before you start answering those deep questions is to try to put aside preconceptions. Shall we say, there's been a long history, and I'm not picking on one religion, but there's been a long history within the Catholic religion of all kinds of, I think we could agree, negative things. People burned at the stake and the Inquisition. So there have been wars that have come out of the Vatican when the Vatican actually maintained an army in the Middle Ages or before. But then does one therefore throw out all of the wonderful lobbying effort that Pope Francis has been doing this year because of the historical painting, shall we say, of prior popes who did things that were not so good? I think we owe it to ourselves and we owe it to our children and this moment in time. We owe it to humanity and life on earth to take a very clear look and put aside our preconceptions. Which is, you know, we have to start looking at reality and not looking at our beliefs if we're going to avoid the worst that's coming at us.
Well, now, this question could involve faith or maybe mass psychology, but I think many of us are hoping there will be a big spark, a big change. Do you think humans can shift quickly from their current state of apathy and denial into action? Are there social tipping points?
Yes, I do believe in that. Revolutions come from social tipping points. I'm not proposing revolution in this case, but revolutionary thinking often comes from very innocuous events. The Arab Spring is said to have arisen from one particular food vendor whose cart was impounded by the police, burning himself alive in front of police headquarters, if I'm not mistaken, in Tunisia. One event, one person's martyring himself, and I'm obviously not recommending as we say jokingly, kids don't try this at home. I like to make the quote, the famous quote of Margaret Mead, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, concerned citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And every time I say that, I'm brought to tears because I think that's what we need. I think we need people to get motivated and not to feel powerless and to actually take action.
Stuart Scott, I said at the outset that your organization records powerful speakers you attract and you post those videos on YouTube. Please tell us about a couple of, that you have available and where we can find them.
Yes, thank you. The United Planet Faith and Science Initiative, I'll call it my baby, sort of, we cooked up something that is now called climatematters.tv. This came out of the press conferences I did in Lima last year and in Bonn, Germany earlier in 2015 before Paris. Instead of doing it a standard press conference, talking to the audience, talking to the press, I tried to reform it as a TV show, TV talk show, and it worked well in Bonn in June, and then we did it in Paris and did 11 of these that were quite successful. So I would urge people to go to climatematters.tv, and the very first one, I'm just posting it today, it will be presentable by the time your listeners go to climatematters.tv. The very first one in the upper left corner is a pet project called Well, it's a Nobel Peace Prize. I took time in several of my Climate Matters shows in Paris to do a non-commercial break, an analog of the usual commercial breaks in ordinary TV. But this was a pitch for something that I was giving away, a Nobel Peace Prize for Sustainable Development. And I would urge your listeners to go to NP4SD.org. That is Nobel Prize for Sustainable Development in an acronym, NP4SD.org. And take a look at the Nobel Peace Prize we're proposing there, which would be a game changer. And we have reason to believe that it's got a good chance if a lot of people do the endorsement, public endorsement, and qualified nominations.
Well, finally, Stuart, I want to put you on the same spot where I find myself pretty well every day. Can we arrange what we have into a better world, or do we first have to pass through a dark portal where much is destroyed before we can get to a new beginning? What do you think?
I'll have to say all of the above. That is, I do believe we can, but it would take a tremendous act of will. It would take something on the order of a second coming. It would take some leader or some charismatic voice or some event for people to really straighten up quickly. I think it's possible. I don't think it's probable. I think we will have to go through some difficult times, and I'm just hopeful that we don't set off what is known as runaway climate change, which might conceivably condemn humanity to extinction. That's a possibility.
Well, I guess that's where faith comes in. We've been talking with Stuart Scott. He's founded an organization which counts some of the world's top climate scientists and religious leaders among its members. It's called the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative. You can follow links in my Radio EcoShock blog, which is published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info, and I'll have a whole bunch of those videos there, plus how to get to United Planet's site. Stuart, thank you so much for supporting the voices that we do need to hear and for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Hello, I'm David Koch.
And I'm Charles Koch.
And we're the Koch brothers.
You might know us just as a couple of chill guys who own the Republican Party. But what you may not know is that there's a major problem plaguing our society. Idiots who claim that climate change is real. Folks, climate change is pure fiction. So we spent billions of dollars assembling the world's hottest conservative pop stars to sing a song that we wrote. We hope it proves to you that climate change is hogwash. Enjoy!
Long ago, Droughts were super common. Earthquakes happened often, and it rained a ton.
Nowadays, rivers are still rushing.
Waterfalls are gushing, and snow exists.
Don't believe the lies you hear,
that the end of times is near.
Liberals are twisting facts, it's a big conspiracy.
That's a clip from the Climate Change Deniers Anthem, created by the comedy group Funny or Die. Watch the whole video at funnyordie.com or chase the link in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
In the media, all we see or hear are relatively wealthy people talking amongst ourselves. Billions of global poor are missing. Many of them are women. Our guest Betsy Teutsch has collected earth-friendly ideas and tech to help them. Her new book is 100 Under $100, 100 Ideas for Empowering Global Women. From Philadelphia, Betsy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Well, you know, I've traveled in the developed world and briefly underdeveloped world, I guess we could say, and briefly witnessed deep poverty in several countries. Yet I feel isolated from that, and I'm almost unable to find language to describe it. Who are the global poor, and how can we talk about them?
Well, one way of talking about them is to say the bottom of the pyramid or the base of the pyramid, people that live on a couple dollars a day. But that doesn't mean much to people in the affluent world because the dollar goes much further in poor countries. So the way that I like to think about it is that these are people that live in low-resource regions. They're poor, but they're also missing a lot of the infrastructure that we take for granted. So not only do they have to live on a really meager income, but they are lacking water provision. They're lacking sanitation, waste management. They're lacking an electrical grid. They're by definition off-grid, not because they're hippies, but because there's no electricity and they have to patch it together with things like single-use batteries, because you can't charge batteries if you don't have electricity. So they live in a life that's full of poverty traps. It's expensive to be poor. They're also missing transportation grid and municipal services. Many of the global poor now live in expanding slums around the world. We call them shanty towns or favelas. They've moved from remote villages to cities, but they're called para-urban slums. They don't have municipal services. That would be even education and police. So people are just left to fend for themselves.
Okay, so in India, the woman often runs the household purse, and in Africa, I've heard that women do most of the work. Is that why you chose to focus on women, per se, or were there other reasons?
The reason I focused on women is that I have really fallen in love with what we call humanitarian technology. There was a great book about 10 years ago called Design for the Other 90%. The way that really cleverly designed durable, attractive, affordable tools can really make a big difference. One of the things that I have in the book is called Solar Ear, and it's a very inexpensive, very effective hearing aid, and it uses solar charging batteries. Because even if you could give a poor person, one of these extremely poor people, a hearing aid, how would they ever be able to afford the batteries? So something like that is so smart, and it just, I love that kind of design. But I noticed when in the various women's empowerment organizations that I've worked with, schools for girls and funding grassroots organizations that are women's empowerment initiatives,
They seem very technology shy, and that reflects the gender divide that you see in technology generally. It's sort of a male domain. In a patriarchy, men literally are the technology gatekeepers. So part of the challenge is that you have to get to the women directly so that they can understand how the technology and these better tools will help them improve their lives. They're already working incredibly hard. So the goal is to get them access to tools so that they can help themselves. You can't just give people these tools. People don't want things that you just give them. We have to create demand. So I figured by focusing on women, that would be the way to unleash a lot of interest in this subject. Women are very effective tools for development. We know that. Educating girls is the most impactful thing you can do for an economy.
Right. Well, you know, reading your work, it seems like any one of these 100 ideas could become a movement in itself. I mean, just the type of stoves that you found, and it could go viral. Is that starting to happen, do you think?
Well, I'm not getting any feeling that in the talks in Paris that poverty is on the agenda. Although I have Bill Gates is talking about getting people out of poverty and, you know, keeping our planet habitable. But when we talk about the big fight seems to be over coal, you know, coal-powered plants and that sort of thing, and that kind of energy provision doesn't do anything for the poor because they're never going to have transmission lines. They're never going to be able to get access to that kind of energy. That will benefit businesses. It'll benefit the economy more generally, but it won't get down to the household level. So I really want to focus on how a household in the developing world could improve quality of life and actually lower their carbon footprint. People don't pay too much attention to the globally poor because, relatively speaking, their carbon footprint is tiny relative to, say, my house in Philadelphia where I live. But there are 3 million households where we could have a huge impact by making sure that people can get solar power, for example. But we're not talking about a solar array of 30 panels. We're talking about one or two panels having a huge impact.
Right. It could provide light for people, including girls, to study at night or get some schooling in or get some extra work done. It's hard to think that in some places when it gets dark, well, it's dark.
Yeah, and people are using kerosene lamps. And kerosene is really smoky. It's a fossil fuel. One of the dirty secrets, literally dirty, is that many governments subsidize kerosene. So they make it cheap and affordable. But it's still a really inferior light, and it's very smelly. It has a lot of toxic fumes that are bad for the planet, but they're really bad for the household. They call it indoor air pollution. It causes a lot of respiratory disease and eye problems and fire hazards. So getting rid of kerosene would be a major improvement for everybody and the planet. And the thing is, a solar light that will replace a kerosene lamp, there's even one on the market called the No Kero light, and that stands for no kerosene. They're very inexpensive now because they use LEDs. LEDs need very little power. They're very efficient. They're hyper-efficient, really. So the lamps now only cost about $10 or $15, and people can actually pay for their own solar lamp by no longer having to purchase kerosene, even subsidized kerosene. So many of these upgrades pay for themselves. It's a question of getting systems in place and people informed.
Now, you mentioned Paris. People like Bjorn Lomborg say we shouldn't bother spending money on alternative energy or reducing carbon emissions. He thinks global poverty is more important. Do we have to choose between the two, Betsy?
Well, that's the thing, we don't. We can do it together. And people, there's sort of a false impression that what we're going to do is expand the kind of infrastructures that we have in the affluent world to the developing world. And that would be incredibly stupid because they're inefficient and poorly designed. It's just that that's what we have and they work for us. But why would we want to replicate them? A great example is our sewage system. We take all this waste, we call it waste, and we treat it and flush it and spend so much energy getting rid of it, and then we discharge it into the water. but there's a whole movement in the developing world and also off-grid called eco-sanitation. And essentially, it captures the assets that are in waste. If they call it poop power, whatever, to be, you know, graphic. And it becomes manure. It becomes humanure, some people call it. It becomes fertilizer. It becomes a soil amendment. But you're capturing it. Also, if you use a biodigester, which you can use animal waste, vegetable waste, human waste, you put it all in there, and it's anaerobic. And it basically is sort of a, like it's a composter, except much faster. And it breaks down into biogas, so you can fuel a stove, say, just out of, you pipe it right out of the biodigester. It's like a landfill, I guess, same idea. And then you have organic fertilizer. So that's the kind of infrastructure that we should be building in the developing world to provide waste sanitation for people, not flush toilets and sewers. That just, A, it's impossible. If you've ever been in one of those favelas, you see that you can't just go add pipes. There's no space.
Exactly.
And it's prohibitive. So what we have to do, the fact that we're missing infrastructure in all of these para-urban slums is actually a huge opportunity to redo things and to redesign them so that they're much more eco-friendly and much more sustainable.
Okay, Betsy Teutsch, what is your fantasy package of tools we need to improve the lives of poor women and their families?
Well, I do dream of this. If we could get each household a small solar panel, doesn't have to be a big one anymore because they're so much more efficient. A relatively small one can be a starter. Then they can add, they already have cell phones by and large. More people have cell phones than toilets in the world, a surprising statistic to a lot of people. And then they can get lights and they can charge their cell phone and their lights from the solar panel, and eventually a lot of people are going to have computers and tablets. They're going to just leapfrog right over having televisions because they can go straight to having a screen that is connected through some sort of Wi-Fi to programming. They need to have some kind of water purification. There's a wonderful product on the market called the Solvatten. It was designed in Sweden. That's Swedish for sun water, and it's basically a big black suitcase that you fill with water, you open it, and you do solar water purification. It takes only about 2 hours. There's a gauge right on it that tells you when your water is ready, and it's so hot that it can double as a hot water heater. If you plant a few trees around people's homes, then you have all kinds of eco-benefits, and they could be fruit trees. The moringa tree is incredibly quick-growing, and it has all kinds of health benefits. You can eat the leaves. Everybody calls it kind of the magic tree. So if you just did a couple of those things, you had a biodigester. They have a balloon style that's much smaller for a household, or a composting toilet so that they could safely have the benefits of separating their waste stream from their water stream. That would be huge. And then you get them an improved cook stove or a combination of cooking techniques so that they're not having to go out and girls collecting wood, which they spend hours a day doing that, and it is deforesting. So you can then let the forest regenerate. So a simple package like that, which is probably just a few hundred dollars, and the family itself can pay for it in savings and improved productivity, would do an immense amount towards shrinking carbon footprints and increasing carbon sequestration. It's amazing how much. There's something called black carbon, which is what is produced when people cook over open fires. They're incredibly inefficient. And from what I have read, black carbon is just a technical name for soot and particulates. And it creates kind of a blanket. It's not technically a fossil fuel, but it does stay around, and it's very damaging to the environment. So get rid of all those carbon soot providers, and we'd have a much healthier air quality.
Yeah, it kills millions of people just from cooking inside with open fires, as you describe, and that soot is traveling up to glaciers in the Himalayas and darkening them, causing them to melt faster, and even makes it all the way up to the Arctic, where I've seen pictures of Greenland that's it's now gray land because of the soot that has arrived there from around the world. And then you have this great big cloud forms over India for part of the year and over China that takes away up to 10% of the sun's power. So stoves, incredibly important, and new ways to do that.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Betsy Teutsch. We're talking about her collection of 100 ideas under $100 to empower global women. Betsy, what about population concerns? Are we really post-peak child? That's a new idea for me. What does that mean?
Well, Hans Rosling, who has this wonderful website, Gapminder, is a brilliant Norwegian, and his field, he's an epidemiologist, I believe. His field is visualizing data. And he shows that statistically we are at, we're post-peak child. We peaked at the number of babies born a couple of years ago, and nobody knows this, it seems. The number of births per mother has just plummeted over one generation. In Mexico, I think it's dropped from 5 to 2 per mother, just as an example. And that's as a combination of better family planning, but it's also educating girls. When you can keep girls in school and then they can go on to secondary school, high school, they postpone the age of marriage. They're more employable. And then they can get jobs. They contribute to the economy. That's the whole Pacific Rim miracle. And they delay fertility. And then when they educated women have many fewer children. That's a fact that we know around the world. So there's about a 200 million women gap in family planning. So if we met that gap, we could get there even faster. But the increase, we're still going to be experiencing a huge population increase. But it's not because more kids are being born. It's because the kids that were born ahead of them are aging, and life expectancy is increasing. So it's all those extra people that were born in the 70s, 80s, 90s, zeros, all those people aging. But eventually, the predictions are that we will max out at, I think, around 11 billion is the prediction, and then we'll start to gradually taper off. So, of course, a baby born in an affluent part of the world consumes much more than a baby born in the low-income parts of the world because there's only so much people can consume. But it's good news. It, obviously, if there are fewer people than we thought there might be, the predictions when I was, I'm in my 60s, the predictions when I was in high school when Paul Ehrlich was talking about the population bomb, that did not come to be. It's actually much better news than anybody expected. And it's all about educating women.
Well, yes and no. I mean, 11 billion people on this planet to me is a catastrophe. We've got 7 billion now, and we're using up much more than the planet can give. So we're going to have to use a lot of the tools in your book to bring it down to where we can have that many people on the earth. So let's say I agree, and I do agree, that you've got a great collection of tools in this book. The challenge always is, how can we communicate with the billions of people who need it? They're not on the internet. They probably can't read, almost definitely can't afford to buy a book. What are your ideas to propagate what you've found?
That's a great question, because you don't want to just preach to the NGOs. You want to reach the people that need these things. There are a number of outlets. Schools are, of course, our biggest hope. And the advances in education, even though the children don't have computers maybe at home, more and more schools are going to be having them. So, and radio is one of the most effective ways. Since we're on the radio, let's give a shout out to radio. In places that are still very low tech, radio is often accessible. People have, communities have radios, and they have radio broadcasting, which is hyper-local. So they can run educational edutainment to explain concepts to people that they might not have otherwise had access to. A really effective way of reaching women is through women's self-help groups and women's cooperatives. They generally are a band of women that are working together. Usually they're farmers. or women that have gotten microloans from a microfinance institution, and there's an educational and leadership component to those. So women are exposed to new ideas, they get a chance to develop more self-confidence and become leaders, and together, women individually, women are very disempowered, but as a group, there's more chance of their being able to really speak up and speak out. One thing that's great about the internet for those that have access is that it's two-way. So it isn't just us telling people what they should do. It's women can be speaking to one another about what they want and what they need, and we can be a little bit more attentive. We have access now to data that no one would have ever had before because of cell phones. So I would expect that the internet in the end is probably going to be the way that people, the demand for it is huge, and a lot of these ideas will come along with it.
So you cover some other topics in the book, such as finance and also some legal things. Just tell us about a couple of the ideas from that section of your book.
I'd love to. I am very much, as I said, in love with the technical, the handheld tools. They're so clever. But I realize that what hampers women is not just the absence of tools. It's patriarchy and legal systems that actively discriminate against women. So I do have a section of human rights. Human rights are women's rights and human rights are the same. So registering the birth of children is very important. Working against violence against women is very important. One of my favorite mashups is a number of women in Egypt started an app called Harass Map, and they used basic mapping skills that you can use, global positioning, that sort of thing. And they designed a map where women can add information where they were harassed in the neighborhood. Often it's when they go to the public latrine, for example. So once women have access to this kind of technology, then they can use it in ways that are useful to them, and they can share with local police. This is a hot spot. This is where a lot of women are getting harassed, and actually they can do something about it. So it's very important that we focus on ways in which women are more legally empowered. And I included a lot of financial tools because I mentioned before that many of these tools pay for themselves because they save money, especially if they're solar. You no longer need to be paying for fuel if you have a solar panel that's charging from the sun. But people need the entry-level buy-in. They don't have enough money to buy a solar panel, but they can buy it on the installment plan. So you need a financial tool to get people over the hurdle so that they can obtain these beneficial tools. So microfinance and insurance, mobile money is huge. In Kenya, for example, most everybody now sends their money electronically. And that's great for poor people because they never had bank accounts. They didn't have access to checking. If they had a cash economy, and cash, women carrying cash is a bad combination. They're extremely vulnerable. This way, they're much more secure, and they don't have to travel places, which is also great from the standpoint of transportation. The fewer people that have to move around, the less gasoline you're going to be using.
Wow, this is like a travel tour. You're telling me things that I have just entirely missed. Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners as we wrap up here, Betsy?
Well, I would just like to tell them that in my book, I knew that people would want to be engaged, not just giving money, but in other helpful ways. So for each entry, I included an item that the reader might want to further involve themselves in. So I tried to make it as easy as possible for people to become activists on their own or supporters of causes. It's important. Being an advocate is extremely important. And with the simple tools of the internet, you can really help get messages out about what's important.
Is there a website, a Facebook page, or Twitter tag where people can follow you and this book?
I am at 100under100.org, and I have a ton of resources on my website. So any kid that needs to write a paper, it's all there for you. My Twitter is at Betsy Twitch. That's my name. And the Facebook page is facebook.com/100under100. So if you like my Facebook page, I keep updating every time I learn something new about one of the tools in the book. They just won an award or they have a new version out. I post that so you can learn more about what's happening in real time with these tools. I keep updating.
Our guest, Betsy Teutsch, has lots of ideas and affordable strategies to start making the lives of global women better. The book is $100 under $100, 100 Ideas for Empowering Global Women. You can find links to Betsy on her Facebook page and following her on Twitter, and I'll put links to all that in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Betsy, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's been a pleasure, and I think people really need to know that we can get people out of poverty and shrink carbon.
Good news. I'm Alex Smith, reporting. From Ithaca, New York, and more lately Venice Beach, California, here is Finian Makepeace singing 2060.
A couple of years ago, I had a dream that really changed the way that I look at the future. I was in a refugee camp as an old man. Climate change had really taken its toll. My granddaughter snuck me under the fence and took me to a city that lay in ruin. And she turned up to me and asked, with tears in her eyes, why I hadn't done something to stop this from happening. And really changed how I look at what we need to do and what we can do, how we can make a big shift and a big difference. So I wrote this song. It's called 2060.
Dark of night, when the fears take flight, I fell into a dream. I'm still haunted and cold, and it shakes my soul to say what I've seen. It was the summer 2060. I was an old man, one of 12 billion men, women, and children. In a sea of sand, in a sea of growing sand. A frail young child, my own granddaughter, led me from the throng. We marched through doorways of endless sorrows. And she sang this sad, sad song. It's too late to hope when the world begins to bleed. It's too late for love when our hearts are filled with grief. She cried, oh, Grandpa, on the way to this hell, how did you justify these wrongs were right, or these actions might not be what bring us down. It was in your power to shift it all. Well, I lay frozen in shame till the morning came. When I felt my lover's kiss, and to my surprise, as I opened my eyes, she described a dream of bliss. It was this summer, 2060, we stood hand in hand. The planet flourished, each soul was nourished with peace throughout the land. With peace throughout the land. Ooh. Ooh. And all the children born free and fearless share the same desire. All for each other, sisters and brothers, they sing in a universal choir. It's too late to bleed when hope has freed the doves. It's too late for greed when our hearts are filled with love. And it's in our power. It's in our power to make it so.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and today we're going to be talking about Burundi and Syria. The general notion is that there is a regime change operation underway, of course, in both places, as we know. Of course, the United States boldly says so. And periodically sort of take two steps back. But then they renew the attempt to remove the government of Syria. And there is a similar exercise going on in Burundi, which gets less attention. We'll be talking to Steve Gowans about Syria and about some of the people who sort of front the position for the U.S. In the political world, namely some people self-identified as socialists, which is kind of funny. And then we'll be talking to our good friend, Mr. Tazira, a Burundian-American who knows a great deal about his country, more than the New York Times, I guarantee you. So those will be our guests, and those are the topics. And I want to just say at the top here that we're going to do a little sports and entertainment. Go and see Dalton Trumbull. It's a great film, and in Toronto, I saw it at the Carlton. I hope it's still running there. I wish it was going to be shown year-round. It's a special film telling us about the history of the Hollywood 10 and it's a story of Dalton Trumbull, who experienced the blacklist because of his alleged political views. When the House Center American Activities Committee and others decided to shut down all progressive thought and work in film, because U.S. Foreign policy had changed, and it was so they cleaned house. And that element of the story isn't treated as well as it might have been. But my gosh, when you get a film like Dalton Trumbull, which stands out. The name of the film is Trumbull. His full name was Dalton Trumbull. But Trumbull lets you see how Hollywood works. It lets you see how people perform under stress when they have their principles at stake, and then they have their stakes at stake, and they have to think about what they're going to do. And it involves several very well-known people who aren't named in the film. Edward G. Robinson was one of the great Hollywood actors. He was a very progressive man, and he believed in, as did the others, in trying to bring equality in America, fighting racism, fighting on the side of labor and all this. But when the hammer came down, he had a nightmare experience where he was part of the group that was going to resist. But, you know, you put people in a pressure chamber and funny things happen. So we experience it with him. And there's a gifted actor who plays Edward G. Robinson. Forgive me for not knowing his name, but it doesn't really matter. Go and watch him act, and then you'll want to see him again and again, because his character has to go from believing firmly one thing and then having a loss of nerve and then, of course, going through a process of self-loathing and then loathing those who got him into this problem. And then, of course, as it all unfolds, it unfolds into a victory for Trumbull, Dalton Trumbull, in that eventually his gifts were recognized, and he was his name was put back on a famous film called Spartacus. And it is a period, and this you could look at Trumbo, and you could then also look into the story of Kirk Douglas and others to really. It's a good starting point for us. And as Gore Vidal said, if you want to understand America, you have to study Hollywood. And so this will tell you a great deal. And also really heartening is the figure of John Wayne, who appears in the film. And we see him for what he was, a bully and a noisy fake. And there's a nice exchange between Dalton Trumbo and John Wayne. It's in the early 50s where John Wayne says to Trumbo, you know, you had to go back to Russia. And so Trumbo asks him about, since he believes so much in American freedom, where was he during the war? Because the people that he's blacklisting all served somewhere in the fight against fascism. And where did he serve? And you really must understand, John Wayne did all his fighting on the beaches of California and did not go and got away with this because whose image of the American, you know, fighter of World War II? It's the movies he made. And, you have to think about that and how that fits in with the narrative that America's created, that a guy like Wayne could be bullying Dalton Trumbo and others and wanting them all to be arrested and just have their lives and their families destroyed when he himself didn't serve. And so it's nicely done, and it needs to be told. I was in the Marines, I have mentioned occasionally, but one of the things that we used to say to one another, if there was a guy in the platoon who was noisy and over the top, some people would say gung-ho or too gung-ho, we would say, don't be a John Wayne. And we meant it as an insult because we all understood that he was a phony. He'd certainly never been in the Marines. And that's nice. Of course, I'm being heavy about it. The film just touches it in such a way that you get the picture. I would say, of course, that the movie is for mature audiences. By that, I mean people who think. And if you're with a younger child in your family, you might put your hands over their ears when it's mentioned that Dalton Trumbo was indeed a communist. I have never heard that in a film in modern times that I'm aware of, where the character who is okay, is decent, is a good guy, and is against bad guys, and they say, his daughter says to him, Dad, the newspapers say you're a communist. And Dalton Trumbo says, and she says, are you? And he says, yes. So then she says, golly, well, is mom a communist? And he says, no. She says, am I? I tell you, by the way, this is a heartbreaking thing to watch, but it's brilliant. And then Trumbo said, well, I have to give you the test. And then he says, if you came to school and you had your lunch as usual, and then your friend, who usually had a lunch, doesn't have one because they don't have the money in the house, what do you do? And she says, well, I share it. And he says, well, don't be in a hurry. Maybe you wouldn't. Maybe you just wouldn't be associate with her anymore. Or you might lend her something at 60% interest. You know, there's other options. And she says, no, you know what I do. I share it. And he said, well, you might be a radical. He says, we have to keep an eye on you. Anyhow, Trumbo. I know it's going to be playing at the Ronce Cinema or something? I think I got that right, on Roncesvalles. And I see the poster up for it. And I hope it's still at the Carlton. The film has not been promoted that much. It got nice reviews, some interesting comment. But, you know, I thought it was a pretty good blow to the gut of arrogant Hollywood. And so maybe some of the moguls, as they called them, weren't all that happy with it. It didn't open in all the big cinemas across North America. It opened in a lower percentage than usual for a film of this quality. So that's that. Go see Trumbo. Now, I want to say something about the football, because here I know I have everybody's ears, because football is a national, some people say, religion. I noticed, for example, last night there were two games. They left 4 hours out of the Sunday in the evenings for those who still practice Christianity. They said, well, you Christians, now that we've had our pagan exercise, you can have 4 hours to whatever it is you do. But everybody else is screaming about football. But we all know that the Washington Redskins, I hate to say the name, but that's the name of the football team, has been asked by Native Americans, please don't use that name. And the owner, who is not a Native American, says, I'm going to do it anyway. So there's been an issue. Washington happens to be a southern city and was known as one of the franchises that was the least cooperative in trying to desegregate football, professional football, saying one of the last. So there's always a question mark over that city and their sports franchises. Anyway, I just noticed something, that they got beaten yesterday, which I applaud, since they were beaten by the Green Bay Packers, who's the only football team in America, North America, major sports enterprise that is owned by the city of Green Bay. Think about it, Toronto. Wouldn't it be great if we actually owned the team as opposed to whoever those guys are? Anyway, so Green Bay wins. And on the playing field, the starting quarterback was the number two talent of the Washington Redskins, and that's because the coach decided his best quarterback, the man with the most talent, and who has proven it, Robert Griffin III, wasn't even suited up because they thought he had an attitude problem, and the whole city got on his case. And basically, he'd been run out of town. I saw him about 2 years ago give his life in a playoff game. He was injured badly, but he was the best guy they had, and so it was late in the game. They had a chance. He had to be out there, but it was going to cost him a leg. I watched him. He could barely walk. So he made one last effort, and it was like watching a terrible B-movie because someone hit him, and he couldn't get up. That was Robert Griffin III. I thought he was about as brave a thing as I ever saw in my life, and I said to myself, watching him play, please don't do this. You don't have to do it. That coach wants you to go out there. The fans want you, but you're going to get hurt. And he was badly hurt, and it cost him a lot of time in rehab and everything else. But anyway, they decided, the white management in Washington, that this guy had the wrong attitude. And so they said, we got a B-level quarterback. We're going to get behind him, and the team will get behind him, and we'll get rid of Robert. Well, they did, and they got as far as you can go with a B-grade quarterback. They got beaten by the Green Bay Packers. Oh, happy day. So, anyhow, we will that's football. But the season isn't over, as you know. Actually, the real season is just going on now. It's called playoffs. The people who make money off this stuff have discovered you can have two seasons. One is the one where you sort of play like, and these players try not to get killed so that they can survive to playoff time. And then when you have playoffs, the real guys show up. And playoffs are very often don't resemble the real season. So if we entered any one idea from all this today, we'll say cities, if people say that's our team, I live there in that city and that's my team, they ought to consider doing what Green Bay did, which is own the team. That way, when you say that, people won't be able to laugh in your face. It's one of the saddest things to watch is when franchises are moved and all those guys with painted faces and costumes are standing there watching the buses drive away because they don't have any say in it at all. Not a nickel's worth.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marcus Stanley of Americans for Financial Reform, who talks about why his group supports breaking up the nation's largest banks to avert future financial crises. Swapna Reddy of the Workers and Immigrants' Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School, who explains why a coalition of national groups are challenging the government's recent deportation of Central American refugees. And Jeremy Veron, of the group Witness Against Torture, who discusses the recent protest at the White House demanding the shutdown of the U.S. Guantanamo prison camp that opened 14 years ago. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A surge in gang violence in El Salvador contributed to a 70% rise in violent crime in 2015, making it the bloodiest year since the Central American nation ended its civil war over 20 years ago. Last year, over 6,600 people were killed in El Salvador, surpassing the number of murders in other dangerous Latin American countries such as Honduras and Venezuela. The current spike in violence is attributed to the end of a ceasefire between two powerful street gangs, Calle 18 and Mara Salvatrucha 13. The Guardian newspaper reports gang members were also targeted for extrajudicial killings by the police. Leftist President Salvador Sanchez Seren has taken a hard line against the gangs and moved gang leaders into high-security prisons. A peace agreement in 1992 allowed leftist rebels to disarm and return to politics. An amnesty went into effect immediately, and no war crimes charges were brought against either government soldiers or rebels. In recent days, however, El Salvador has agreed to cooperate in the arrest of 17 former soldiers implicated in the 1989 murder of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her daughter. Investigations of 1980s atrocities, including the brutal massacre at El Mazote, have reopened deep wounds and led to an effort to revoke the amnesty law. 5 years ago, New York labor activist Renan Salgado received a phone call about five Mexican migrants who were trafficked to work as food vendors at the New York State Fair. The migrants were forced to live in a bug-infested trailer and paid a sub-minimum wage. After a court fight, the Worker Justice Center obtained back wages for the workers. Salgado recently told the Christian Science Monitor, "The case really showed how connected trafficking is to the frame of our economy." Migrants, often recruited overseas with the promise of a good-paying job, travel to the U.S. with temporary work permits. But working conditions in the U.S. can be harsh, and employers often threaten to report undocumented workers to immigration officials if they complain or quit. A 2014 report by the Urban Institute found 71% of trafficked workers had been given a government guest worker visa through their employers. In the tomato fields of southwest Florida, human rights activists and groups like the Coalition of Immokalee Workers have fought to end the worst abuses of labor trafficking in an area known as Ground Zero for human slavery in the U.S. Big box stores like Walmart and fast food restaurant chains, including Yum Brands, now require food suppliers to submit clean labor audits. And for the first time, agricultural companies have agreed to provide their workers shade tents in the fields, mandatory water and bathroom breaks, and a penny-a-pound bonus for tomato pickers. Farm worker advocates are currently pushing further for Fair Food Program labels that let consumers know that produce sold is grown and packed ethically, free from labor abuses. U.S. factories have used assembly line robots for 50 years, which has led to decades of labor anxiety. New innovation in robotics, artificial intelligence, and computer power is expanding quickly and reigniting the fear of losing massive numbers of blue-collar jobs. Still, most economists say major job losses cannot be blamed on robotics or automation. By 2000, U.S. industry was operating over 100,000 robots in factories, yet the overall manufacturing workforce remained stable with 18 million workers. Steep job losses were only seen after China joined the global economy and became the workshop for the world. Economist Danny Roderick of the Institute for Advanced Study says that slow job growth since the Great Recession can be attributed to weak consumer and business spending, not new technologies. Yet researchers at Oxford University say robots remain a threat to low-skilled workers, the same group of people who have the most difficulty securing new employment. While some blame rising inequality on the rise of new tech industries, progressive economist Dean Baker instead maintains that misguided public policy that encourages financial sector growth and suppression of the minimum wage are major factors in the growing gap between the rich and poor. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, independent senator of Vermont, has long supported legislation that would break up America's largest banks, a measure also backed by Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren and other progressive legislators and economists. As he campaigns to win the Democratic Party nomination, Sanders says we must break up too big to fail financial institutions. Those institutions received a $700 billion bailout from U.S. taxpayers and more than $16 trillion in virtually zero-interest loans from the Federal Reserve. He maintains these institutions have acquired too much economic and political power, endangering our economy and our political process. Many economists assert that 1999 legislation, supported by Democratic President Bill Clinton and congressional Republicans, that deregulated the nation's big banks, contributed to the 2008 financial crisis that triggered the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. Among the laws scrapped under the 1999 Graham-Leach-Bliley Act were the 1933 Depression-era Glass-Steagall Act that separated commercial and investment banking. Today, Bernie Sanders' candidacy is focusing renewed public attention on proposals to impose tougher regulations on big banks and Wall Street, measures that public opinion polls find receive strong bipartisan support. Your reporter spoke with Marcus Stanley, policy director with the group Americans for Financial Reform, who talks about why his group supports breaking up the nation's largest banks to avert future financial crises.
There's, of course, been a debate about Senator Sanders' remarks and this attempt to kind of retroactively look back to 1998 or 1999 and the details of Glass-Steagall and the details of all the deregulation that was done. I think it's more useful to look at the actual legislation that Sanders is endorsing, which is the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act. And what the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act, which was legislation introduced by Senators McCain and Warren, what that legislation does, it's a little bit different than the original Glass-Steagall Act, but it has the same idea, the same spirit, is it's aimed at the rise of what's been called universal banking, which is banks that essentially do everything. They're involved in every element of the financial system, from taking deposits and making loans, traditional commercial banking, to being the major dealers in the complex financial derivatives that are traded on Wall Street, to being also major dealers in securities and in bonds and the kind of toxic asset securities that help bring down the economy. They do commercial banking, investment banking, just across the board. And the rise of universal banking, it's very clear that over the decade prior to the financial crisis, there was a major increase in the size of banks and in the complexity of those banks that dominated Wall Street. And these universal banks like Citibank, J.P. Morgan, I guess the combination of Bank of America and Merrill Lynch was a universal bank. They really were the banks that helped to hypercharge the crisis and made the crisis really the kind of global Great Depression level disaster that it was. The rise of these universal banks is also I think a big reason why the government was pushed into these bailouts, because these banks were so central to the economy and so significant that it was felt that it was just too risky to let them fail. So there was kind of almost a holdup that government was in, where these banks behaved irresponsibly. They deserved to fail, but the fear was that the economic fallout would be so catastrophic that they couldn't be permitted to fail. So cutting these big banks down to size, we think, would have a lot of positive impacts. It would lessen the political power of the financial industry. It would put government in a position where you could let a bank fail and let that bank be restructured to be a healthy entity and experience the consequences of its actions. So we do support that.
Many people have written about the power of Wall Street and financial institutions in the United States to get their way in Congress through, you know, enormous amounts of campaign contributions to legislators. So you think Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, and all these giant banks have the power to block publicly supported move to break up the big banks?
Well, our polling consistently shows that that the public wants tougher regulation on Wall Street, and they have succeeded, I think, in, you know, Dodd-Frank did make regulation tougher, but I think the public wants to go beyond Dodd-Frank. The public wants to see still stronger regulation, and the banks have been successful in heading off those efforts in Congress so far, but they haven't been successful in rolling back Dodd-Frank. They haven't been successful in eliminating the CFPB. So we're at a bit of a stalemate in Washington in terms of the power of the big banks. They have a lot of power, but I think the public is energized and is more attentive to these issues than ever before. So it's a tough and continuing fight, because there's enormous amounts of money at stake and very complex and technical rules, and the banks can fund a constant lobbying presence to hammer on all of those rules, when often the general public might not even know that these battles are going on. So it is a tough fight, but I believe that the public is on the side of stronger action.
That was Marcus Stanley, policy director with the group Americans for Financial Reform. Find more analysis and commentary on measures to break up America's largest banks by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. At the beginning of January, 150 immigrants who arrived in the U.S. over the past 2 years, fleeing violence in several Central American countries, were arrested after being declared eligible for deportation. These were mostly mothers and children who turned themselves in at the U.S. border, were sent to immigration jails for processing, and released to the community while awaiting hearings in immigration court to determine if their stories were credible and they would thus be eligible to remain in the U.S. In almost all cases, those picked up did not have legal representation. Rallies to protest the raids by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, a division of Homeland Security, have been held around the country. On January 5th and again on January 11th, a notice signed by a total of 240 groups was sent to both the U.S. Attorney General and the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, stating that many of the immigrants are disabled, as defined by the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, because they suffer from severe trauma. The notice requests that the government suspend ongoing raids pending a review to determine whether the asylum and immigration proceedings that led to these families' removal orders complied with federal disability law. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Swapna Reddy, a third-year student at Yale Law School and an intern with a Workers and Immigrants' Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale. Here she describes the situation many of these recently arrived immigrants find themselves in, what assistance is being offered, and the government's response to her group's request for suspension of raids and deportation.
What the letter is saying is that these families who've suffered severe trauma and have developed disabilities, including post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, and depression, are disabled as defined under the Rehabilitation Act, and the government is required to make reasonable modifications for individuals who are disabled due to this law. And so what we are asking the government to do is to make sure that it identifies families who are disabled under the Rehabilitation Act, that it provides immigration proceedings that are trauma-informed to ensure that these families have an ability to tell their stories, and that it provides counsel for refugee families who are unable to tell their stories because of the severe trauma that they've been exposed to. We are also asking the Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice to take these disabilities into account before considering which families to target in raids, which often occur very early in the morning with armed guards coming into families' homes and taking children directly from their beds. They're obviously another source of significant trauma and can exacerbate symptoms. And so we're asking the government to think carefully about the disabilities that these families suffer from and to try to modify its procedures to make sure that it's giving these families a fair chance at their cases.
So what if the government doesn't respond or responds and says it disagrees with you and will proceed to arrest and deport these families? Is a lawsuit the next step?
We hope that this letter is the beginning of an ongoing process to receive modifications for these families to ensure that they are not deported back to dangerous situations for reasons outside of their control. We have not set in stone any ongoing plans because we are waiting to see how the government will respond to our requests. In the past, we have brought suit against the government for situations in which we believe the government was in violation of the law. However, we have not made any substantive plans thus far.
So, Swapna Reddy, it seems like you had no trouble getting lots of groups, hundreds of groups, to sign on to your letter. It seems like it really touched a nerve.
I mean, this really is an issue that touches on a lot of problematic areas. We're talking about thousands of Central American families. The average profile is a very young single mother with young children. Many thousands of these families have been held in immigration detention centers. So as refugees who came to the U.S. and presented themselves to border immigration officials, they were then held in jail where they had limited access to medical care. And these are many of these women and even children are victims of severe sexual violence and gang and gender-based violence. And so there really are a pretty large number of groups and issue areas that are really concerned with the treatment of these families, whether it is women's rights groups, disability rights groups, faith-based and labor groups. There's an enormous amount of intersectionality on the problems that are affecting these families.
So is the government agnostic on whether or not these people have suffered what they say they've suffered, but the Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials say these immigrants just didn't follow the rules and therefore are eligible for deportation?
Yes. Well, the government, either because they believe that the families did not state a valid refugee claim or because the family simply did not show up to court or had an incompetent lawyer who didn't actually make their case fully, they are now saying that the families are eligible to be removed from the United States. And we are arguing that without reasonable modifications and without allowing families to present their cases in a way that is trauma-informed, the families have not actually had a fair shot. And just to provide two anecdotes about the strength of these families' cases, if they do have competent counsel, there was a detention center in Artesia, New Mexico, that was opened up to incarcerate many of these families. And in that context, immigration advocates took on 15 cases. They finished them through the conclusion, and they were able to win 14 of them. And the sole 15th case is on appeal currently. And in Texas, in the nation's largest family detention center, which has 2,400 beds, another student, Conchita Cruz, a professor from Columbia Law School, Elora Mukherjee, and I created a national system to ensure universal representation to every family that was forced to proceed through their entire immigration case while detained. And in that context, we did not get to choose which cases we took on. We just took every case that the government forced to go to trial in jail. And we have been able to win every single one of those cases. So we do believe that these families with competent counsel, the vast majority of them have winning claims and would be able to win their refugee status in the United States. The issue is the procedures are not trauma-informed and that these families often have incompetent or no counsel.
That was Swapna Reddy of the Workers and Immigrants' Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School. Find more information on recent ICE deportations and immigrant advocates' response by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A protest at the White House on January 11th marked the 14th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and demanded its closure. A broad coalition of human rights groups, including Amnesty International, the Center for Constitutional Rights, Code Pink, and Witness Against Torture, called on President Obama to expedite the transfer of the remaining 103 prisoners held at the facility, some of them in prison without charge or trial, after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 terrorist attacks in 2001. Many of the same activists at the recent White House protest have participated in similar actions, calling for the shutdown of Guantanamo after President Obama failed to make good on his pledge to close the prison within 1 year of taking office in January 2009. The Obama administration maintains that Republicans in Congress have blocked his initiatives to close Guantanamo, but many activists maintain that Mr. Obama could have done more. In recent interviews, White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough says that the president is determined to close the prison before his presidency ends in January 2017. Activists demanding the closure of Guantanamo decry the treatment of prisoners held there, described by some human rights groups as torture, involving such methods as force-feeding and sleep deprivation. Since it opened in January 2002, 9 prisoners have died at the facility. Your reporter spoke with Jeremy Varon, an associate professor of history at New School University and a spokesperson with the group Witness Against Torture, who talks about the ongoing human rights violations at Guantanamo and the goals of the protest.
We've been gathering in Washington since, I believe, 2006, and then a robust coalition has built itself over time. We're all motivated by the same thing, the desire that the United States obey the rule of law, respect human rights, and finally close Guantanamo. This year was especially significant because we're entering the last year of Obama's presidency, and this is his last year in office. The thing he did first on his first day in office was pledge to close Guantanamo within a year, and that clearly hasn't happened for a variety of very complicated reasons. So we were saying in this rally that this is the last chance for leadership for the president. His Guantanamo policy, however well-intentioned, has been really a horrible mess. And then at the rally, I said very strongly that a portion of his administration will end in disgrace if he doesn't close the prison, whatever other good things he may have accomplished. And then I said also that that might sound like a harsh judgment, but it's a standard set by the Constitution to which he pledged allegiance, and then his own words in which he declared torture un-American. And then if he has this conviction, he needs to demonstrate the courage of his conviction, push past congressional obstacles, which are very real, push past public opinion obstacles, which are very real, and do the right thing for the right reasons at last.
Jeremy, list for our audience some of the violations of human rights as well as international law that you see as being crossed in Guantanamo all these years.
I mean, sure. I mean, one is that, you know, torture of various forms, physical and psychological, was practiced at Guantanamo, was practiced in other places, Abu Ghraib, Bagram, black sites in Afghanistan and Europe and parts of Asia. But some of the notorious torture techniques were used there, beating people's heads against walls, you know, brutal physical beatings. People have had bones broken, you know, severe concussions, et cetera. And then a whole slew of psychological torture, exposure to intense cold, intense heat, the constant playing of music, being kept up for days on end, and then the practice of force feeding for those prisoners who resist through hunger strike. And then to be force fed is to have plastic tubes rammed down your nasal passage into your stomach, and it's very, very unpleasant, and they often do it in a particularly brutal way. So, you know, one thing is that it violated common sense standards of the prohibition against torture. And then initially they claimed that these people had no rights under any system of law whatsoever, not U.S. federal law, not the Geneva Conventions, not the International Convention Against Torture, because the claim is that they were enemy combatants, an entirely novel kind of combatant not covered by any of these agreements. And then their status was litigated for years, and there were many very important Supreme Court cases that sort of won back to the detainees some rights that the Bush administration had tried to strip. But sadly, the grant of those rights hasn't materially affected the circumstances for a lot of men there. And then the main thing here is that they were granted the ability to file a writ of habeas corpus and then challenge their detention in federal courts. And then some men won their hearings, but the courts didn't have the power to order the military to release them, or the government kept appealing and then wound up with a standard for these rulings that is so preposterously favorable to the government that it became hard to win these rulings. And then we consider, you know, indefinite detention without charge or trial for men who the government admits pose no security threat to be a form of torment, if not a form of torture, and certainly something we should be ashamed of. And right now, 44 men have been officially cleared for release by the government, and then many, many more could be safely resettled.
What were some of the specific demands that this coalition of groups brought to the White House with them on this 14th anniversary of Guantanamo opening its doors?
Right. I mean, the core demand is essentially unchanging, close Guantanamo, you know, and then within that, at a more policy level, Obama could expedite the transfer of people cleared for release. And there was some recent reporting talking about what an obstacle the Pentagon has presented for a variety of reasons. So sort of lean more heavily on DOD to release people, and then to think about exercising executive authority to close Guantanamo by executive order if Congress doesn't agree to its closure. And then this is something that the administration has, you know, sort of vaguely threatened but never really concretized as a plan. And then another thing that we believe is that Guantanamo should close, not simply change its zip code. And then if you held on to the principle of indefinite detention without charge or trial and stuck people into a supermax federal facility somewhere in America, you would just be relocating the problem, not solving it. And then, you know, bear in mind that some of the guys who've never been charged or tried, I mean, they're not formally guilty of anything. And if you throw them into Florence, Colorado, you're putting them in barbarically austere conditions that the jailers themselves say are meant to sort of destroy the mind. So you could argue that that represents an exotic form of cruelty, that you would put people who haven't even been charged into the most restrictive prison in the United States. So the hope is that he sees this as a legacy issue and then figures out in the last, you know, 11 months or so, you know, how to make this happen, you know, as much as he reasonably can. And then the odds don't look good, because it's hard to imagine Republican Congress will ever consent to a plan. But it's also important to emphasize that his administration itself has been part of the problem, and to present it as only part of the solution thwarted by the Republicans is really too favorable and an inaccurate view of things.
That was Jeremy Varon, an associate professor of history at New School University and a spokesperson with the group Witness Against Torture. For more views on the campaign to close down Guantanamo, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
I want to thank Sisters Charlene Carruthers and Dr. Angela Y. Davis for allowing me to join them tonight at this Black Radical Conference. As we meet tonight amidst the storm and drang of embattled Black life in America, as we witness the cop riots of violence against Black life in the midst of neoliberal America, in the age of Obama, no less, it's vital that we learn the lessons of history, especially during the COINTELPRO era. As many of us know, history, real history, tells us more about today than yesterday, for it provides a roadmap of how we got here. Several days ago, I asked two very brilliant sisters, both with doctorates in history, what was the central objective of the FBI's COINTELPRO operation? Both women, being historians, drew on their memories to recall the now infamous memos of February and May 1968, where the goals to destroy, disrupt, and neutralize Black leaders are stated clearly. So both were right, to a point. I asked about their central objective, not their various goals. The central objective wasn't merely to destroy, say, Martin Luther King, for example. It was to replace him with a figure of their own choosing, to essentially take over the civil rights and Black freedom movement by placing their puppet on the throne. I know. To most of you, this sounds paranoidal, even fantastical. But that's only because most of you haven't read the transcripts of the famous Church Committee hearings of November and December 1975 in Washington, D.C. If you check, it's pages 6 and 59. This plot was personally approved by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover in January of 1964. It was in all but name an attempted coup, the toppling of a Black leader to impose a puppet that they could control. It was, in essence, the same thing that happened in Iran, in Guatemala, in Haiti, in Iraq, and in many, many countries. What happened abroad, on the periphery of empire, was tried here in its interior. For in a white nation, Blacks are eternal foreigners, aliens, and thus outside the realm of alleged constitutional rights. For if this can be done against a mild, nonviolent Christian minister of the Gospels, what can be done against you? Under the surveillance and infiltration of the Black Freedom Movement and killings of people like Deputy Chairman of the Illinois Chapter of the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton, in his sleep, by the way, we see that the FBI functioned as race police. They also demonstrated what we see all around us today, the culture of police impunity. For where else can you kill a man in his sleep and no one goes to jail? The road from the state murder of Fred Hampton on December 4th, 1969, leads directly to the killing of young Laquan McDonald in recent days in Chicago. For both are expressions of the ugly and recurrent phenomenon of police impunity, the right to murder if the victim is a Black person. Today, as the U.S. embarks on a new century, it's perfectly acceptable to large segments of the American population to beat someone to death, to shoot them, to choke them to death, to even bomb them, as was done in Philadelphia, May 13, 1985, the Move House, especially if those persons are Black, men, women, even babies, with perfect impunity. How can this be? Historians show us that once we understand origins, we can then begin to comprehend outcomes. Most square traditional historians suggest that the role of police crossed the Atlantic after the founding of the Metropolitan Police in London, 1829. But American roots of police were born quite differently and for different reasons. Founded as slave patrols in the 1720s in the Barbadian British colony of the Carolinas, the body of armed white men had one primary duty: control Africans as a large labor source. Their movements were monitored daily to to protect the property of the landowning class. Africans called them paddy rollers, a term of derision, truly, partly to mark them as poor Irishmen who rolled up on them on horseback. As a teenager, I heard my elders use the term whenever a police van rolled by. They called them paddy wagons for reasons similar to their ancestors. Times change, of course, yet some things remain. In this neoliberal era, when the political class sold the remaining shreds of their souls to the corporations and dispatched millions of jobs overseas under NAFTA and CAFTA, the role of police sharpened as they were equipped with weapons of war, ostensibly in response to fake wars on terrorism. We saw the real role in Ferguson, 2014, when unarmed black protests against police repression and state exploitation were met by automatic weapons, sniper rifles, tear gas, and tanks. Remember COINTELPRO? All of those acts, although illegal, were answered by impunity. The neoliberal state, now presiding over an open crisis of capitalism, goes one step better. In a moment of national fear, think 9/11, it passes the so-called Patriot Act, and voila, in one fall swoop, every crime of COINTELPRO is made legal. Phone tapped, constant surveillance, snitches and rats, black sites, secret prisons, no problem, because it's all legal. Because everything police do in a police state is legal. But the quote moves John Africa, just because it's legal, don't make it right. Now, Black Lives Matter enters the cipher. Born by women, grown by women, nurtured by women, it is beautiful to behold. It's movement time again. We welcome you. Right on. I conclude by suggesting some ideas on solutions. As a student of history, let me point to Dr. Huey P. Newton and the Black Panther Party's late ideas advanced in February and March of 1980. Principally, they advocated the abolition of existing police structures, for they are often instigators of problems rather than solvers. Secondly, they proposed the establishment of a citizens' peace force, a series of bodies based in the community. Their role, moreover, would be based on principles of public service, not this madness we now see as a dystopic RoboCop war against the people kind of thing. These are revolutionary ideas, not reform agendas. For to say the least, we now know that reforms promoted today by politicians and corporate think tanks, such as body cams, for example, are utterly failure and are a reliance on a technical fix that ignores the real nature of the problem. I thank you all, my dear colleagues, Charlene Carruthers, an impressive young organizer from Chicago, and Dr. Angela Y. Davis, the model of a scholar activist, who, when I was a Panther teenager, I proudly protested for her freedom when she was a prisoner at the New York Women's House of Detention. I thank you all. On the move, long live John Africa, and all black lives matter. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Reverend Pinckney, Reverend Edward Pinckney, is the kind of preacher that Martin King would admire. Rather than build a mansion and live like a prince, Pinckney has, for years, advocated for his community, fighting for water rights, fair elections, and social justice for the people of Benton Harbor, Michigan. Because of his political activities, he's been targeted by the government, tried by the Michigan political machine, tried before an all-white jury, and convicted of allegedly altering 5 petition dates. Incredibly, Reverend Pinckney is facing 10 years in prison. Remember the petitions? They were recall petitions of Benton Harbor's mayor, a politician owned and operated by the Whirlpool Corporation, the real owner of the town. For speaking out against this corporate political domination, Pinckney became the target of the legal system. At trial, no one even claimed Reverend Pinckney altered anything. He turned in hundreds of petitions against Whirlpool's puppet mayor. That was crime enough, apparently. As Reverend Pinckney approaches his second year in Marquette Prison, his support is growing across the country as he fights his appeals. The call to free Reverend Pinckney is growing. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Thank you. What are the fundamentals underlying the economic turmoil gripping China over the last 2 weeks? Does the collapse in Chinese stocks consolidate the global dominance of U.S. economic power worldwide, or does it do the opposite? Where do the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the One Belt, One Road project figure into economic plans for China and the region? Why is the infusion of more and more cash into the Chinese economy translated into more and more debt? How are other countries' economies likely to be affected in the wake of the Chinese stock market collapse? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a special look at the financial events of the first 2 weeks of January with two analysts, University of Manitoba Professor of Political Studies Radhika Desai and Dr. Jack Rasmus, Economics Professor and Author. On this week's show, the Chinese stock collapse and prospects for the broader global economy. Conversations with Radhika Desai and Jack Rasmus. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 15th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. This past week, markets all around the globe convulsed greatly with almost nothing left unscathed. There was a different excuse each day for the drops. We first heard about the Saudi-Iran disconnect of diplomatic ties, then everything was down because of the yuan devaluation and their market hitting the 7% circuit breakers. I even heard someone say that everyone has such great profits they wanted out, but not until the 2016 tax year, which is why they waited until the first week. I do not believe any of it, and would instead say we are simply receiving a global margin call. That comes from the article, Financial Meltdown, The Central Role of Credit, The Global Margin Call, Impasse in Monetary Policy, by Bill Holter, posted January 13th. Obama evaded the real issues that affect tens of millions of working people in America every day of their lives. He painted a ludicrous picture of economic recovery and social progress that insulted the intelligence of his television audience and went unchallenged by the millionaire politicians assembled in the chamber of the House of Representatives. Summing up what he called the progress of these past 7 years, Obama gave first place to how we recovered from the worst economic crisis in generations. The so-called recovery has been a bonanza for corporate profits, stock prices, and the wealth and income of the super rich. For the working people, who are the vast majority of the population, it has been a disaster. That comes from the article, Obama's Final State of the Union, Lies, Evasions, and Threats, by Patrick Martin, posted January 13th, originally appearing at the World Socialist website. In contrast to his decision to protect Nazareth and Christians, Dunkelman and his soldiers were ruthless in driving out Palestinians from many of the more than 500 Palestinian communities raised by Israel in 1948 and afterwards. In Safuria, a large Muslim village a few kilometers from Nazareth that was attacked by the 7th Brigade a day earlier, barrel bombs were dropped on the village as the residents were at home, breaking that day's Ramadan fast. All of Safuria's inhabitants were driven out and their homes destroyed. Today it is an exclusively Jewish farming community called Tzipori. Without a doubt, Dunkelman directly participated in the mass expulsion of many tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians from their homes, a war crime by the laws of war that had recently emerged in the wake of the Second World War. That comes from the article, Why Israel Has Silenced the 1948 Story of Nazareth's Survival, the Only Palestinian City That Was Not Ethnic Cleansed, by Jonathan Cook, posted January 13th,
originally appearing in The View from Nazareth. The Syrian Air Force has targeted a convoy of 20 tankers smuggling oil from territories held by ISIS on the Al-Mayadin highway near the city of Deir al-Zar. A top commander of Al-Qaeda-linked Ahrar al-Sham terrorist group, Abu Talib, was killed in a trap explosion in the Idlib province. The Syrian army, SAA, and its allies clashed with al-Nusra and Harakat Ahrar al-Sham at the village of Jarijza, located north of the terrorist-controlled town of Al-Rastan. The SAA reportedly killed about 25 militants and imposed control of Jarissa as a result of these clashes. Next expected aim of the Syrian forces is the town of Al-Rastan. That comes from the article, Syrian Air Force Targets ISIS Tanker Convoy Smuggling Oil En Route to Turkey. Top Al-Qaeda Commander Killed, by South Front, posted January 13th. Washington's aim to replace Iranian sovereign independence with Western-controlled puppet governance risks direct confrontation. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's top military aide, Major General Yahya Rahim Safavi, explained the formation of a Tehran-Moscow-Beirut-Damascus-Baghdad anti-Washington-Israeli-Saudi coalition. On Wednesday, Putin and Obama spoke by phone. A Kremlin statement said both leaders called for de-escalation of the tensions that arose in connection with the crisis in relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Putin seeks regional calm and stability, polar opposite Obama's imperial agenda supporting ISIS and other terrorist groups, stoking endless conflicts, allied with Riyadh, Israel, Turkey, wanting Iranian sovereign independence eliminated. That comes from the article, Does Washington Plan Greater Middle East War? Is War on Iran Still on the Pentagon's Drawing Board? By Stephen Lendman, posted January 14th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. As the Asian stock market comes to the end of its second week of trading in 2016, Chinese stocks continue their massive sell-off. China's benchmark index, the Shanghai Composite, ended its January 15th trading day down over 20% from their most recent high on December 22nd. The Chinese stock market's volatility is apparently impacting world markets. The January 7th shutdown of the market provoked drops of more than 2% in the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500. Japan's Nikkei dropped 2.3% and Hong Kong's Seng Index fell 2.8%. Franik Lun, the chief executive officer at GEO Securities Limited in Hong Kong, told the International Business Times, quote, "The bottom has fallen out of the market in the last 2 weeks. Investors have lost confidence after 2 weeks of meddling by government officials," unquote. China's previous bear market occurred in August, when $5 trillion were wiped off of global stock prices. On this week's Global Research News Hour, we look at the fundamentals of the Chinese economy and the recent stock market activity and try to determine what they portend for the global economy going into the future. My first interview is with a Manitoba-based professor of political economy who has been watching the Chinese situation and who appears to be not as panicky about China's prospects as other pundits in the mainstream. She last visited China around the time of the collapse in the summer of 2015. Radhika Desai is professor at the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group based at that institution. She's the author of the 2013 book Geopolitical Economy After U.S. Hegemony, Globalization and Empire from Pluto Press, among other books. And she's authored numerous articles in Economic and Political Weekly, New Left Review, Third World Quarterly, and other journals. She also organized last September's inaugural Geopolitical Economy Research Group conference. And she joins me right now to share some of her thoughts about the recent shocks affecting the Chinese stock market. So, Radhika Desai, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for asking me, Michael.
Now, I know that you've a major focus of your research and work has been the notion that the nation state is and has remained a critical tool in the development of global capitalism, and that the U.S. Is waning as a dominant economic power. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm just wondering if you would just care to, you know, just give a quick assessment of what this Chinese stock market collapse means in terms of with regard to your own work. I mean, does it confirm or does it refute your thesis?
I think that the first of all, let me say that there are several worrying things that are going on in China right now. One is that there is the fall of the renminbi. The second is the stock market crash. And the third is that there are numerous reports of a credit bubble. Naturally, none of these things are good news. However, I think that the extent to which, you know, how bad the news is highly exaggerated in the Western press. And I would say that I expect the Chinese economy and the Chinese economic managers to weather these storms quite well, largely because I feel that China's growth story has been quite a remarkable one since the onset of the reforms in 1978, and particularly starting in the 1990s. Chinese growth has been extremely robust for 25 years or so.
7% per capita.
Yeah, it has had quite a remarkable growth run, and I don't think that it's going to stop necessarily. Yes, the Chinese economic growth, which was posting 10% growth rates, is now posting 7% growth rates, but even 7% is still substantially higher than what any of the Western economies have been able to post in recent times. So I would say that that underlying strength remains, and that underlying strength is largely a function of the fact that the Chinese economic managers have kept up a relatively high level of investment. And they determine the pattern and pace of investment in China. So I would say that that is likely to continue.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's just adding to that, though, is that what some people would argue is, well, you know, we've also seen an explosion of government debt in just the last 7-8 years. That's quadrupled. Okay. So does that not? I mean, it's one of the most Chinese government. It's one of the most indebted countries in the world, and so I mean, a lot of that translates in the minds of a lot of pundits that that much debt and is like, how are you going to service it? Is that not a consideration when you consider this Chinese?
I think that definitely. I think that there is a – okay. So in order to understand this indebtedness, one has to understand that the way in which China dealt with the 2008 crisis, et cetera, was that basically it stepped up the rate of investment in the Chinese economy enormously. And naturally, this investment was connected with or was powered by a large expansion of credit. Now, the existence of credit is not really the most necessarily the worrying thing. The really worrying thing is whether the capacity to pay exists. And I think that while there may be a certain amount of bad debts in any kind of investment expansion, there will be some bets that fail. And I would say that then those debts may be written off. The important thing to remember here is that the Chinese financial system is owned by the is a government-owned financial system, and it is quite resilient and capable of writing off a lot of debts. And I think that the extent to which there will be bad debts in the Chinese system, again, can also be exaggerated. I think that it is quite capable of writing off the bad debts that will come up in the next little while, but I don't think that it will be a system-breaking thing.
Okay. Now, of course, you've got this BRICS alliance, right? You've got Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and they've been posed as that counterpoint to the U.S. hegemony, as it were. And I'm wondering now with this latest development, what kinds of shocks might be present that might affect the sustainability or the stability of that alliance?
Well, I think that personally I have always, while I do think that BRICS is not an unhelpful concept, and there is a sense in which the BRICS economies do have coordinated their actions at the international level and in a meaningful way, and they are in many ways transforming the structures of international economic governance. At the same time, I also put China in a class of its own. I think the Chinese economy, you were mentioning earlier that I have I talk about the centrality of the role of the state in the economy. This is obviously at one level a simple a refutation or a simple contradiction of the dominant neoliberal theme that only markets promote growth and states only interfere in economies and so on. And the most important piece of evidence against neoliberalism is that the most dynamic economy of the last several decades of neoliberalism has actually been the most state-managed economy in the world.
The least neoliberal country
in the world has been the most dynamic, has posted the most robust rates of growth, has lifted enormous numbers of people, millions of people out of poverty, etc., etc. I mean, it has China's production structure has moved up the value chain quite substantially. It is no longer merely competing on low wages. I mean, all of these are very, very critical transformations, and they have been effected by a government that has, by and large, steered the economy fairly skillfully. Of course, like in so in that sense, I would say that the Chinese economic growth remains slated to continue. We were discussing.
I was wondering because there are competing factions within the governing apparatus of China.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, like, who seems to be prevailing in the current milieu?
Well, I certainly, it's not while I do not have any inside knowledge of the Chinese Communist Party, I certainly, from looking at it from the outside, following what's going on, looking at the reportage of the debates taking place within China, I would say that there is definitely a right and left faction in China. And the recent decline of the renminbi is a very important episode in the contest between the right and the left. The right would obviously like to pursue rather unrestrained capital account liberalization, allow the internationalization of the renminbi to take a form which is very similar to that of other major currencies, particularly the dollar. And the left in the Chinese Communist Party would be very cautious of this. They are very aware of the sorts of problems such internationalization can bring, particularly that it requires levels of financialization which the Chinese can ill afford if they are going to continue this high level of growth. So in a certain sense, basically, people are looking at the decline of the renminbi and they're thinking, well, if the U.S. rhetoric was to be believed, the renminbi was undervalued and the liberalization of the controls over the renminbi should have led to a rise in the renminbi. Why is it falling? The chief reason it's falling is because the capital account liberalization has led directly to a vast amount of capital flight from China. And I think that if the Chinese, the managers of the Chinese economy and the Chinese capital account are observing this, they will realize that this will be the result of capital account liberalization, and they need to go back to managing the capital account much more directly and much more cautiously, and not look at the kind of internationalization of the renminbi that, say, would mimic the dollar or anything. So I think that that's the most important lesson. And I think that this catastrophe of the renminbi should be an object lesson and should actually strengthen the hand of the left in China.
Okay. Well, we have seen a tendency away from that China as major export-oriented economy to more domestic consumption. And we like one of the developments that we've noticed, you know, that's gotten some attention is that the whole idea of the creating all these ghost towns that nobody is occupying, or at the very least that there are you know, apartments and facilities and so on that are priced outside of what the domestic population can afford. So I'm wondering if that in some way translates into a lack of confidence in that
model of...
Yes. I think they're two related but slightly different issues. So let me just take them up one by one. So the first is that you're talking about the reorientation of the Chinese growth path. And I think one of the things we must note about it, and I think people even in the mainstream financial press are beginning to note, even IMF World Bank figures are beginning to note, is that... Is that the Chinese economy is now consciously, Chinese Communist Party leaders are consciously pursuing a path of economic growth that is led by the domestic economy, that is focused on the domestic economy. So they are not looking for markets abroad. They are looking for markets within the economy. And that implies two things. Basically, one, you step up the level of investment. And number two, you seek to increase the level of consumption of your own population, which can only be a good thing. In fact, it will also hopefully rectify a problem that has emerged in the Chinese pattern of growth, which is rising levels of inequality. If the government focuses on creating growth by stimulating demand of its own relatively poorer sections of the population, I think this will also lead to a relatively greater reduction of inequality in China. And of course, with 1 million-plus people, it will be an enormous stimulus to growth. So that's one thing. The second issue was about investment. And you were talking about these reports that are often splashed around the Western press about, you know, cities in which nobody lives and roads that go nowhere and so on. And yes, there have been such reports. But my understanding is, and I'm here relying on the work of a friend and colleague who's been studying the Chinese economy very closely, very often it turns out that it's a bit like the dated picture story that we are seeing with these the hungry people in Syria and so on. Pictures are taken at a moment in time when, say, a project is completed, but people have not come to live there. And often within a few months, a month or two, this place is actually populated and it's being used and so on. So again, while there is always a possibility that investment can overshoot, and that it is likely that there are some instances of such empty roads or buildings, they are, the extent to which they exist have also been highly exaggerated. So yes, and of course, by the way, investment overshooting can happen in any economy. In fact, this happened in the 1990s in the United States, where the pressure of the dot-com boom, there was a huge and misdirected investment in the ICT sector. And now there is an overcapacity, which the United States economy is still suffering from in this sector in particular. So I would say that, again, this is something that the problem that this represents is exaggerated in China.
Now, I'm kind of interested. There are a couple of developments in recent years that do seem to threaten the larger, to be affecting a larger global transformation of economics. That one being the development of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, mm-hmm. and the other the One Belt One Road project, and these seem to be, in my layman's view, like kind of doing an end run around the institutions like the Bretton Woods World Bank, the Asian Development Bank in Japan. And so I'm wondering how that's going to impact, given the current global environment.
Well, I would say that it has the potential to absolutely revolutionize international economic governance in a variety of ways. I mean, revolutionize may seem like a strong word, and I don't think that, developments may unfold gradually or very fast. I cannot predict that. But nevertheless, look at it this way. For many decades, the world has lived under a system of international economic governance, which has been powered by the insistence that countries open up their capital account, and they have been told that if they do so, then Western capital will flow into their economies and allocate, investment in a judicious and proper way, and they will expand the productive capacity of all these economies. But typically, what has occurred is the complete opposite. opposite. Countries that have liberalized their capital accounts have not had any productive capital flowing in. On the contrary, the only kind of capital that has flown in is short-term capital that comes in like a herd and goes out like a herd. And when it goes out like a herd, it causes currency crises. Sort of the most dramatic instance of such currency crises was the East Asian economic crisis, where, you know, whereas throughout the 1990s, as capital accounts were liberalized, there was one financial crisis after another, the tequila crisis and the Russian crisis and even the Swedish crisis and so on and so forth. But the point is, the East Asian financial crisis was particularly important because it hit otherwise dynamic economies whose with which there was nothing wrong, whose fundamentals had been praised by everybody just before the just days before the crisis occurred. So what that East Asian economic financial crisis showed to people is that this kind of capital can come in and go out. So if you wish to maintain an open capital account, then you also need to engage in reserve accumulation, which tends to divert funds away from productive investment, even more funds away from. So not only are you not getting in funds for productive investment, keeping an open capital account requires you to accumulate reserves, which further diverts more money away from productive investment. Now, this is the scenario so far. Now, what the Chinese are offering is a completely new pattern of finance. And I'd like to say a couple of things about it. We say that the Chinese economy suffers from a great deal of inequality. A large chunk of this inequality is regional inequality, and part of the regional inequality stems from the fact that the west of China is relatively underdeveloped. All this booming growth has taken place along its eastern seaboard. So this new Silk Road, Asian Infrastructure Development Investment Bank, One Belt, One Road, etc., all these initiatives are together not only looking westward to Central Asian republics, to Russia, to Europe, and to India, and so on, but it is also focused on developing China's own west. And I think that can only be a good thing. So yes, that's very good. Number two, abroad, what they are offering the rest of the world is a pattern of finance, which is the complete opposite and in a practically every way of the Western model of finance. So it is offering long-term capital, not short-term capital. It is offering productive capital, not speculative capital. It is offering capital in a format which does not require capital account liberalization, and therefore it would not require expensive reserve accumulation. So if you think about all these things, the patterns of finance are completely different. Now, I would say that we are looking at the eclipse of one pattern of finance, the Western US-led, and the rise of the sunrise of another, sunset of the one, the sunrise of the other, primarily because it's a no-brainer. For any governments trying to develop their economies, they can see that the other one is better. And the one single sign that those who are the cognoscenti realize that this is happening is that Britain, despite the vocal objections of the United States, has joined the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank, because the British have one very important objective, which is to retain London's position as the center of world finance. Now, if their ears are to the ground, if the ears of the City of London are to the ground, then they will realize that that this is the new pattern of finance.
Sounds Britain like a barometer of sorts.
Exactly. And that London better have a hand in it so that it can start specializing and become a sort of hub for this new type of finance. And absolutely, this is a remarkable indicator, you know, because for the last century, the City of London has played a sort of subordinate role to New York. Now, will it be playing a subordinate role to Shanghai instead? This becomes a very interesting question.
Yes, indeed. And I suppose as we watch on in the months and years to come, we'll start to see answers to that. Radhika Desai, I want to thank you very much for sharing your analysis and your insights with us.
Thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with Radhika Desai, professor at the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group based at the University of Manitoba.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Jack Rasmus is a professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. His research focuses on global economic inequalities, and he has a new book out all about the global economic crisis. It's called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. Dr. Rasmus hosts a regular program called Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network, and many of his essays appear on the Global Research site. So, Dr. Rasmus, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure for being here.
Okay, so first of all, I just wanted to quiz you a bit on your own understanding of the recent turmoil affecting the Chinese stock market.
Well, if you look at the immediate causes, what you see in China going on is a mutual exacerbating effect between the currency decline, the stock market decline, and the real economy slowing down. By the way, that real economy is slowing down much faster than it's being reported. China says it's 6.9% GDP growth rate, but I believe it's actually 5% and maybe even less. Some say it's as low as 3%, independent researchers. In any event, it's much slower than it is. And, of course, when your economy slows down, that means the businesses aren't doing very well. And they're not going to increase their profits and their revenue, and therefore the stock price isn't going to go up. Therefore, if the price isn't going to go up, it may go down. You want to get out of the stock. So that's one of the forces that's behind the stock decline in China, which really has begun to unravel since late last June. We had a 35% decline in the stock market between June and August, which was the result of a massive bubble that had occurred in the stock market over just the previous year. Stocks had risen by 120%. That's clearly a bubble. We'll talk about the causes of the bubble a little bit if you like, but now we're on the second downward leg since the end of December here in the stock market, and that's a reflection in part of the growing problem of debt in the private sector among the industrial companies, manufacturing companies, and so forth in China over the years here. Another factor is the currency decline. The yuan, the currency, is under great pressure to decline. And, of course, if your currency declines, then the value of the investments you're holding in that currency declines simply because the currency declines. Well, if the investment is the stock price and so forth is going to decline because you expect the currency to continue to decline, then you want to get out of stocks as well. And then, you know, we have a situation where the stock market decline puts pressure on the currency decline. In other words, if I'm selling stocks, I'm going to cash out my stock. I'm going to get paid in yuan, right, the Chinese currency. I'm then going to want to get my money out of the stock market and out of yuan itself and buy other currency. So I'm going to sell the yuan. I'm going to increase the supply of yuan, and the yuan's going to decline even further. So we have this mutual three-way effect going on between the currency decline, GDP slowing down, and the stock market decline. That's all mutually determining each other, and it's all going south. And you see it reflected in this massive capital flight coming out of China since the stock market began to decline. If you look at government efforts to support the yuan, the currency, and to support the stock market in the past year, and capital flight, private capital flight, we have about $1 trillion at least of money flowing out of the markets and out of China itself in the past year, $1 trillion. That's a huge amount of money that otherwise might have been used for investment, whether it's financial investment or real investment. So that's what's going on there in China, massive capital flight. And to the extent that, by the way, I would say another force here, to the extent that the dollar rises, long-term interest rates rise, and therefore the U.S. dollar rises, Global oil continues to decline. There's a direct inverse relationship between global oil, the crash in global oil commodity prices that began in the middle of 2014, and the rise of the dollar. They're both linked. So that decline in the price, because oil is a financial asset, not just a physical commodity, you see, since 1999, that exacerbates the whole situation. And the situation is not just China. China's obvious, you know, since it's so large and so important as a single economy in the global scenario, but all the emerging markets are in the same boat. In other words, currency decline, capital flight, and slowing economies and so forth. When you have a currency decline, policymakers can do one of two things. They can raise interest rates to try to keep money capital in their economy, but of course that slows down their real economy as well. Or they can use their reserves, currency reserves on hand, to buy the currency to keep it from falling. China has massive currency reserves, of course, but they've committed at least $500 billion to support the stock market decline by getting Chinese government banks and Chinese government state-owned enterprises and other sources to buy currencies to keep the stock market and keep the currency up, you see. But it's not working. Even though they have these massive reserves, it might slow down the collapse, the implosion in the financial asset markets, the stock market, the currency market, and so forth. But it's not going to stop it. Well, emerging markets like in Latin America and elsewhere, they don't have those kind of reserves, and their economies are just plummeting, and they're going to continue. I've been saying for some time that we're heading towards another financial crisis, but it's not going to be in the U.S. or even Europe. It's going to come from emerging markets. China's going to precipitate it and then control its collapse because it has these reserves, but the emerging markets aren't going to be able to. You see, in 2009 and 10, China stimulated its economy with a 15% of its GDP, a massive fiscal stimulus, direct government investment and spending and exports. And that massive spending, fiscal spending, as well as an accompanying monetary stimulus, drove up the China's economy to 10, 14% GDP growth rates. Well, the rest of the emerging markets provided commodities and semi-finished goods to China, so their economies boomed as well. So China pulled up the rest of the emerging markets, and the growth was so lucrative in China emerging markets that this massive monetary liquidity injection by the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, Bank of England, so forth, which is $20 to $30 trillion since 2009 in QE and zero interest rates. Much of this huge liquidity injection flowed into China and emerging markets. All right, flowed out of the U.S. That's why we didn't get a very fast recovery in the U.S. We have a 1/2 to 2/3 normal recovery. Because the money flowed out, and the money also flowed into financial assets and speculation. That's why you see the stock and bond markets in the U.S. Double tripled with huge capital gains and money, and thus incoming inequality, further trends in the U.S. One of the main characteristics of 21st century capitalism is this shift, as I call it in my book, to financial asset investing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty important consideration because, I mean, we're talking about – when we talk about like real assets, we're talking about something like concrete, like literally, you know, with you know, building and with, you know, stuff that's creating jobs, as opposed to financial assets where we're basically talking about money making money, debt making money.
Yes, well, see, the liquidity injected by the central banks, $20 to $30 trillion, however you measure it, turns into debt. The central bank gives this free money because interest rates are zero. Banks and shadow banks, particularly, that's the unregulated banks, you know, equity funds and hedge funds and so forth, can go to the central bank and get free money, essentially. And what do they do with that free money, this $20 to $30 trillion? What they do is loan it to other investors, other businesses, if they're multinationals, or then they themselves invest it. Where do they invest it? Well, when China and emerging markets are booming, they may invest it in real assets. In other words, buildings and plants and equipment and so forth. That's real assets. But they also invest it in financial assets, securities, stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, and so forth. So a lot of the money flowing out went into both financial assets and into real assets offshore. In the U.S., it mostly, in Europe, it mostly went into financial assets. And that's why we get these stock bubbles, these financial asset stock and debt bubbles. So the liquidity turns into debt, you see. That's what's important to understand. You can't have this massive increase in global debt, which according to estimates by the Bank of International Settlements is $40 trillion since 2010 through 2013. The BIS is located in Geneva. It's kind
Bank
of
the International
Bank
Settlements.
Of the central banks, you might say. It does
okay.
a lot of research. And they've been raising this flag for a couple of years, and correctly so. It's probably at least $50 trillion in additional debt since 2010, much of which has gone into financial speculation and financial assets around the world.
So a debt boom is what you do in 2012?
Yeah, well, the debt, is the big problem that led, excess debt led to the 2008-09 problem. There, the debt flowed into property markets and other credit markets associated with it, and the prices got to an unsustainable level, and when they collapsed, the ability to pay for that debt, the principal and interest, collapsed, and then the financial assets collapsed. That was the problem back then. Well, we got a similar problem brewing, but it's not in properties and housing and so forth, and it's not in the derivatives that were the problem back then, CDSs, CDOs, and so forth. Today it's in new forms, in new places, but it's there, you see, and it's going to explode, especially in emerging markets where most, at least $25 trillion, half of this $50 trillion debt has accumulated, and the debt is accumulated heavily, like in places like Latin America, in dollars. So Latin American countries have to export more in order to earn dollars to pay the interest on that $25 trillion debt. The problem is the global economy is slowing, so they're not earning those dollars anymore. And it's harder and harder for them to pay that debt, and we're going to see defaults as a result.
Okay. Just going back to China, and you were talking debt. Their total debt's risen from $7.5 trillion to $28 trillion last year. So that's China's just about the most indebted country in the world at this point. So,
oh, yes. It's a massive debt problem. And I have a chapter in my book, Systemic Fragility, just on China, as well as on just on Japan, Europe, emerging markets, and the U.S. So I look at this debt problem in all these areas. But the debt problem, you have to understand, is really the liquidity problem. Liquidity translates into the debt problem. And the debt problem by itself is not sufficient to look at. It's the ability to pay for the debt, i.e. income flows, in relationship to the debt. You just can't talk about this huge run-up in debt and say, that's the problem. Well, how does debt translate into the problem? Well, it's the inability to pay, to make payments on the debt. Because when you accumulate huge amounts of debt, when you have a cyclical downturn, a recession, your income falls, right? If you're a company, a business, or a government, because your tax income falls. So the income available to pay for the debt declines, but the debt never declines, you see. The debt is really there, and that's the problem, because if you can't pay for the debt, make your payments on the debt because you don't have the income, well, then you default. When you default or about to default, your expectations of default mean that your prices of your assets collapse. See, they totally fall, and that sets off a financial panic that goes from one market, credit market, to the next credit market. Because the people who are buying and using all this debt are the same people around the world. In my book, which, by the way, you can obtain going to my blog, jackrasmus.com, or you can just go to Amazon if you wanted much more detail there. The problem with the debt is the ability to pay for it, that relationship. Most economists don't understand that. You know, mainstream economists think, oh, well, debt is good. It's okay. You know, people use it to finance real investment. No, they're using it to finance speculative financial assets because they are far more profitable than investing in real assets anymore. That's why we have this shift to financial speculation and financial asset investment going on. And we have a structural change in the 21st century capitalist economy in which we have this new finance structure of shadow banks all around the world that are sitting on, estimates are, you know, maybe $100 trillion in investable assets, $100 trillion.
How many of those shadow banks are in China currently? I mean, that's a recent phenomenon in China, right?
Yeah, in 2009, there were no shadow banks in China. And that's part of the problem why we have this huge liquidity escalation in China that has led to this debt in China. Part of it has been the government pumping the People's Bank of China, their central bank, pumping all this money liquidity into the economy to feed this fiscal stimulus that they had. But they also, China also opened up its economy to Western shadow banks, you see. And the U.S. has been putting pressure on Beijing for years to do that. And now, you know, they progressively did that. And also various kinds of shadow banks arose for the first time in China. You know, there's thousands, about 6,000 shadow banks, the estimates I've seen, in China, purely domestic shadow banks of various kinds, some very small, others very large, you know. Plus the Western shadow banks play in China. They buy and sell. They've been buying commodities outside China. They sell those commodities in China when there was a big demand for those commodities. Then they convert that money from the commodity sales in China into Chinese currency, yuan, and they speculate in China. A lot of that speculation back in 2011-12 resulted in this huge boom in local government infrastructure and housing spending. That became a bubble. The local governments, borrowed from shadow banks and other sources, and they engage in this huge building boom. And of course, when you borrow, you have all that excess debt, and they caused a bubble in property prices. Well, China tried to start controlling that bubble around 2012-13 by slowing down the construction. By raising interest rates. But every time they did that, they slowed down the Chinese economy itself, the real economy. So after a while, they got a little smarter, and they figured, well, you know, we instead of trying to eliminate that bubble, let's divert all the speculation somewhere else. So they moved the money by various incentives out of the bubble, the construction bubble. They moved it into what's called asset management products.
And that just created another bubble there.
That created another bubble, right. The idea was WIMPs, wealth management products, as they're called, were designed to fund the investment in state-owned and other industrial enterprises, which, you know, to expand manufacturing and so forth. So the money flowed out of the property bubble into the industrial bubble, you might say, entrusted loans, they were called. And they created a bubble in entrusted loans, and industrial enterprises in China became heavily indebted as well as local government, you see. And then they figured China, the China policymakers in late 2013, figured, well, we're trying to make this conversion from direct government investment, which is about 45% of the GDP there, and export driven. We're trying to move it to consumption and private investment driven, was the whole idea. You may have read about this conversion thing. Then to do that, they tried to divert the bubble out of entrusted loans and speculation on the industrial side into the stock market. You see, this big balloon in the stock market, 120% rise in 1 year, is in large part the consequence of Chinese government policymakers inviting more shadow banks, more foreign money into the stock market, and also pretty much eliminating any controls on what's called margin buying for average investors in the stock market. And by margin buying, you know, it means you increase your debt and you don't even, the government doesn't even have to provide money. Margin buying is if the value of your stock or your financial asset is accelerating, the broker will loan you the equivalent of the value increase to buy more stock. So you get all these retail investors and those small investors jumping in late 2014-15, borrowing money from and increasing their own debt, borrowing money from brokers and so forth, and foreign money. All that boosted up the stock market. And the idea was if we get more people investing in stock, the company's stock will rise in value. And because it rises in value, the company will be more apt to use that profit, that capital gains profit, to expand the real economy, to invest and expand the real economy. And high-end consumers making profit off of the stock market will increase their consumption. Hence, you know, we will boost through a stock bubble, we will boost the real economy. That's called the wealth effect, you know. But it didn't work. It just resulted in more
what we're
more
seeing
problems.
Now, yeah. Ultimately.
Huh. Same thing has happened in the U.S. You know, the Federal Reserve pumping all this trillions of dollars into the economy was really designed with the same logic in mind. In other words, let's create a wealth effect in the stock market where all these companies would get so profitable that they would then, you know, divert some of that profit into expanding the real side of their economy, and then consumers also will be able to those playing in the stock market will have a wealth effect, and they will consume more. At least the top 10% that play in the stock market in the U.S. But it didn't happen here either. You see, that's the capitalist monetarist approach. Let's boost the incomes of corporations and speculators and the high end. And because they're so filthy rich now, they will trickle down some of it into real investment, and that will pull up the rest of the economy, jobs, and so on and so forth. But they're not doing it. They're sitting on the money, you know, in the U.S. They're hoarding their cash or diverting it into financial markets or diverting it offshore for a while. That stopped in the last couple of years, or they're just sitting on it. If you look at the U.S. alone here, corporations, you know, the profits more than doubled. They issued $5 trillion in new bonds, which means they get, you know, money in exchange for the bonds. And what did they do with all that money? They gave it back to their shareholders, right? $7 trillion of returned cash to shareholders in stock buybacks and dividend payouts just in the U.S., right? Yeah. And globally, corporations are still sitting on $7 to $8 trillion in cash. So $15 trillion has been created and either remains on their balance sheets or they've returned it back to their shareholders. But where's the real investment from this? You know, the whole faulty logic of mainstream economics is that if you supply side is that if you somehow increase the cash flow on hand of corporations, they will then automatically, ipso facto, invest it in expansion, and that would mean more jobs and more income and more spending and therefore GDP. That's mm-hmm. the supply-side logic. But it's not working. They're hoarding it or they're diverting it into financial assets around the world. You know, these 200,000 of what I call the new finance capital elite, there's about 200,000 of these investors, about 70,000 in the U.S., and they're the ones who have created all these liquid markets for all these new financial securities, derivatives of all kinds, and that's where they're investing because it's so much more profitable
exactly.
than investing in real assets that create real jobs and real things and real income by real people. That's the big shift in capitalism in the 21st century.
Now,
that's what is meant by financialization. It's this whole picture, this whole changed financial structure, the new liquid markets, the new finance capital elites, the new securities. You can move them around now electronically, immediately. And this is what they're doing with all their wealth, you see, and it's not trickling down anymore.
So what is the global outlook for, resulting from these developments? Do you see winners? Do you see degrees of losing? How is this going to play out?
Yeah, well, those who get into these financial bubbles first, you know, those who know where they're coming or create them themselves are the winners, and those who get out late are the losers, and the big losers are usually the small retail investors, they call them, you know, the mom and pop who thinks that they can play in foreign exchange markets and stock markets, derivatives, and so forth. And they lose their shirt. And it's like a global money parade. The money moves into this particular market in this geographic location. Okay, we got a bubble. Now we're going to pull out. We're going to go over here. And the money just keeps circulating around. And the real economy languishes as a result. And we see these financial bubbles begin to implode. The Chinese stock market is an imploding bubble, and it's about to have serious effect on the rest of the stock markets because it's the same 200,000 people who are driving these markets everywhere. And the contagion is psychological, at least on the financial asset side. Who's going to win? Massive capital flight out of emerging markets in China. The people who are moving their capital out are going to be winners. So, it's just sitting out there. This time bomb is sitting out there. And all the huge debt increase on top of that is sitting out there. And once the income starts declining more rapidly, which is driven by the price declines, we're going to see a lot more defaults.
Okay.
And that psychological effect, then we're going to see the stock markets really collapse.
Well, Professor Rasmus, I want to thank you very much for your analysis and remind our listeners that they can read more about your insights into the deep fundamentals of our current global crisis by getting a copy of your book. It's Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, and it's available at through jackrasmus.com. You can get some material there as well as on Amazon.
Yeah, there's some free chapters on my website, and you can get to it from jackrasmus.com. There's a photo jacket of the book. Just click on that. I have a chapter free for anyone to read there on China, my view of China and what's happening there and what will happen and the contagion effects that are coming here for the rest of the global economy.
Jack Rasmus, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with Jack Rasmus. He is a professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and the author of Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.